This is a recording of Intellectual Colonialism and Airbud Theology, More on Queer Theory and the Church of Jesus Christ by Gregory L. Smith, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship, read by Victor Wirth. Review of Taylor G. Petrie, Queering Kinship in the Mormon Cosmos, Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina Press, 2024, 214 pages, 2194 paperback. Abstract. Taylor Petrie's Queering Kinship in the Mormon Cosmos attempts to, quote-unquote, queer Latter-day Saint concepts to create an account more congenial to queer theory, a postmodern philosophy and approach to texts. Here, the aim is to destabilize and deny sexual essentialism, the law of chastity, and the eternal destiny of humanity as understood by the saints. The words of church leaders are misrepresented through omission and reorganization. Readings of Latter-day Saint scholars and scripture likewise suffer distortion, inaccurate representation. The work betrays several double standards, including the intellectual colonialism inherent in the efforts to distort and thereby appropriate Latter-day Saint culture and writings for its own purposes. Means to avoid this negative pattern are suggested, including rigorous honesty in textual claims and the participation of the scholarly community in effective peer review of irresponsible or misleading work. Taylor Petrie is one of many in academia who undertake the queering of history and theology. His latest book, Queering Kinship in the Mormon Cosmos, is the second half of a project begun in his previous work, Tabernacles of Clay, page 7. As I previously reviewed Petrie's earlier work, I thought it appropriate to examine his latest scholarship. Foundational concepts. What exactly is queering, and why ought the Mormon cosmos to be subjected to it? Queer was long used as a slur against homosexuals. Gay rights activists reappropriated it and, quote, used it provocatively to convey an assertive and radical alternative to conventional notions of sexuality and gender, close quote. Latter-day Saints can doubtless understand why a persecuted minority might, in a show of resilience or defiance, embrace a mocking label, like Mormon, bestowed by their enemies. The term queering is part of queer theory, an academic movement that is notoriously difficult to define, and this is regarded by its advocates as a good thing. In this regard, queering is a verb. It is something that is done to something else. It is a process or an evaluation from a particular point of view. In the balance of this review, when I use queer, queered, or queering, lowercase, non-italicized, I am using the term as a verb referring to a process. If, however, I refer to queering, uppercase, first letter in italics, then I am specifically referring to Petrie's book, the subject of this review essay. It should be clear that it is important to define terms in an effort to facilitate understanding. Toward that end, I will first distinguish between sex and gender, and then sketch queer theory's intellectual antecedents in broad strokes. Doing so requires a brief tour of postmodernism, with emphasis on its strategy of deconstruction. This will bring us to queer theory proper. Sex versus gender. Until relatively recently, sex and gender were essentially synonyms when describing humans. During the last century, quote, sex came increasingly to mean sexual intercourse, close quote, which led to gender often, quote, replacing it in early use euphemistically as the usual word for the biological grouping of males and females, close quote. Current scientific, medical, and sociologic work makes a clear distinction between the two. Feminist scholarship often insisted on the differences, though these distinctions were subsequently challenged by some queer theorists. In present-day technical discussions, sex refers to biologic sex, the physical state of being an embodied male or female, normally with reproductive potential and the appropriate internal and external genitalia and secondary sexual traits. Gender, on the other hand, refers to the traits or social roles attributed to individuals by their culture because of their sex and their internal psychology. Queer theory draws on these distinctions, but given its suspicion of binaries and skepticism of claims about the essence of things, see discussion below, there is often considerable blurring. In making my argument, I will use the terms in the precise sense described above, but will reproduce the terminology used by queer theorists when quoting them. Postmodernism. Queer theory derives in large part from the postmodern project, especially the philosophy of Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault. It shares the methods and intellectual stance of many other species of so-called critical theory in the humanities academic hothouses. American readers may be familiar with critical race theory, which applies similar tactics to issues of race rather than sexuality. Fundamental to these ideologies is the idea that all communication, or discourse in the jargon, must involve issues of power and hierarchy. This power is not necessarily imposed top-down, though it might be, but is instead an omnipresent web of social control and influence of which we may be completely unaware, but in which we all participate. It is worth noting that any who dispute this characterization can simply be said to be unaware of the real truth of the matter, which only the enlightened theorist can see. This is a handy, if circular, and unfalsifiable escape hatch. We can also enjoy the paradox of such an absolutist claim about the truth of how things really are being made by those who ostensibly reject claims of absolutes and settled truth from anyone else. A fixation on issues of power is combined with the broader postmodern concern about subjectivity. Put briefly, postmodernism denies our ability to access objective truth, since all evidence is filtered and interpreted through our biases, often in self-serving ways. Even if we found truth, we would not know we had. There are no stable categories, no fixed points of reference. Insisting otherwise is said to be a delusion or part of an illegitimate effort, conscious or not, to enforce unjust power relationships. From whence comes the fixed category of just or unjust in this analysis? It is best not to expect logical consistency. While some believe that the message found in any act of discourse is a joint product of author and audience, in its more extreme forms, postmodernism holds that no meaning exists until it is created by the audience, independent of any facts outside the subjectivity of the audience. Even the author's intent has no bearing on what the audience can or should receive. Deconstruction. To justify these stances, postmodern theorists often use deconstruction, a complex set of tactics difficult to summarize fully. To deconstruct a text is, quote, to show how it undermines the philosophy it asserts, or the hierarchical oppositions on which it relies, by identifying in the text the rhetorical operations that produce the supposed ground of argument, the key concept or premise, quote, unquote. Postmodernists are critical of logocentrism, quote, the privileged role that logos, or speech, has been accorded in the Western tradition, close quote. Critics have summarized deconstruction as opposing, quote, the concern with truth, rationality, logic, and the word that marks the Western philosophical tradition, close quote. Quote, deconstruction is better viewed as unduction, as the negation, reversal, or contradiction of all methodological attempts to achieve knowledge or truth, induction without end and without conclusion, close quote. Philosopher John Searle mentions three of the deconstructionist's many strategies, and we will soon see how prominent they are in queer theory. One, first and most important, the deconstructionist is on the lookout for any of the traditional binary oppositions in Western intellectual history, e.g. speech and writing, male and female, truth and fiction, literal and metaphorical. These hierarchical oppositions allegedly lie at the very heart of logocentrism. The aim is to resituate, undo, or displace the entire system of values expressed by the classical opposition. Two, a second strategy is to look for certain key words in the text that, so to speak, give the game away. Three, a third strategy is to pay close attention to marginal features of the text, such as the sort of metaphors that occur in it, because such marginal features, quote, are clues to what is truly important, close quote. We see this worldview at work when Queering's author writes on social media that, quote, the Bible is always read through a specific lens, and it is the lens that matters, not the book itself, close quote. Queer theory proper. If postmodernism and deconstruction are difficult to describe succinctly, queer theory is even more so. Quote, "The pliant nature of queer theory has enabled it to maintain relevance by insisting on its own radical unknowability," close quote. Quote, "Queer is a deliberately ambiguous term that is simultaneously a way of naming, describing, doing, and being. This is where queer theory finds its radical potential as a term to challenge, interrogate, destabilize, and subvert, but it also means there is difficulty in pinpointing queer theory's meaning," close quote. Above all, queer theory seeks to undermine the sexual binary and all that goes with it. Quote, "It is a radically anti-essentialist theory, arguing that everything, desire, sexual norms, and gender, certainly, is interpretable as social construction and open to challenge and change," close quote. Social construction implies that sex and or gender are not genuine essential categories that exist regardless of what humans think or desire. Instead, they are merely conventions established and maintained by society, often with oppressive intent or results. For the queer theorist, being either male or female is certainly not essential or foundational to who and what we are. For example, Petrie claims that both sex, presumably biological, and gender, quote, "are historical and ideological, not natural and fixed," close quote. Since sex and gender are merely cultural creations, we are free to modify or ignore them at will, and such things certainly cannot tell us how we ought to behave. This attack on heterosexual male-female norms is foundational and explicit. Quote, Michael Warner most famously notes, subquote, "The task of queer social theory must be to confront the default heteronormativity of modern culture with its worst nightmare, a queer planet," close subquote. Warner coined the term heteronormativity to describe the pervasive and largely invisible heterosexual norms that underpin society. An example of heteronormativity in practice is the representation of ordinary family units as comprising a mother and a father, and where alternative family arrangements are either not represented or are depicted as a deviation from this norm, close quote. We note that activism is a prominent part of the theory. Quote, "Beginning in the 1990s, queer theory took radical political energy and translated it into philosophical academic language and applied it to the interpretation of a variety of cultural forms," close quote. Quote, "Several of the main areas of thinking and political action that have influenced queer theory," close quote, "include," quote, "lesbian color theory and activism, lesbian feminism, post-structuralism, postmodernism, lesbian, gay, and bisexual activism, gay and lesbian studies, trans activism and theory," close quote. This is no shameful secret. Its partisans are quite clear, quote, "When we situate queer theory within a particular academic genealogy, we must acknowledge that it has always also been inflected by histories of activism and resistance to oppressions," close quote. A map for what follows. We will explore Petrie's ideological project in four parts. In part one, we will examine how he treats historical material from church leaders. We will see blatant misrepresentation and distortion of their words, and a failure to follow the basics of sound historical practice. In part two, we see how these flaws grow out of queer theory's approach to texts. In part three, having thereby established the intellectual context, we'll examine three attempts by queering to queer scripture and church doctrine. We will again see unjustified claims, including citations to the literature that do not support the argument being made, and a failure to grapple with the extensive literature that disagrees. In part four, we will conclude with some broader perspectives on intellectual colonialism and the double standards embodied in queering's approach. Part one, disordered cosmos, distorted text. Quote, "I argue," close quote, Quirin declares, quote, "that the scriptural text and its interpretive history do not preclude gender and sexual fluidity," close quote, in God or Humanity. This claim requires considerable unpacking, but we should first recognize it as a striking example of what one wise friend has called Airbud theology. For those who do not recall this cinematic gem, Airbud is a Disney film starring a dog who plays basketball. when the opposing team protests at the manifest absurdity of having a dog on a basketball team, the dog's coach retorts, quote, "You check in your rule book, bet you don't find anything in there that says the dog can't play," close quote. Now, the proper answer to this would be, quote, "Only a moron would think there would be," close quote. In the interest of the story, the referee replies, quote, "He's right. Ain't no rules say the dog can't play basketball," close quote. Hijinks ensue. As we will see, queering offers us Airbud theology. Ain't nothing in scripture that explicitly comes right out and says that God and humanity can't be sexually fluid. That's slightly sillier than a dog wearing high-top sneakers. This sort of sophistry is a good example of why ambitious intellectuals have always preferred a religion based on a book to one based on living prophets. As queer theory affirms, and as we shall see, queering demonstrates in shameful detail, any scriptural text can be made to say anything if one works at it doggedly. Infuriatingly, modern prophets talk back. Distorting Spencer W. Kimball. Back-talking prophets are more easily dealt with once safely deceased. The humble ellipsis is a marvelous tool for such efforts, and much other propaganda for that matter. It is unmatched in its ability to hide while revealing, especially if the target is not around to protest. It gives a scholarly sheen to dull dishonesty. Gerald and Sandra Tanner, for instance, are masters of the technique. All too often, I have seen ellipses used to disguise an inconvenient fact. Their methodological errors have continued the tradition. Queering and its predecessor volume are no exception. For example, Spencer W. Kimball could sue Tabernacles for libel if he were still alive. Tabernacles claimed, quote, "Kimball noted that homosexuality and bestiality were both deserving of the death penalty and that, regrettably, the law is less severe now, as was the community's attitude," close quote. What Kimball wrote, in fact, was that, quote, "like adultery, incest and bestiality, they, homosexual practices, carried the death penalty under the Mosaic law," close quote. Note that this says nothing about such acts deserving the death penalty. Instead, he argues that in the Old Testament, God declared such acts sinful, just like heterosexual adultery. Kimball elsewhere points out that Sabbath breaking is a rebellion with dire consequences, although, quote, "Israel's swift and severe punishment for infractions is not exacted today. This does not lessen the seriousness of the offense to the Lord for violating his day," close quote. By Tabernacle's logic, the prophet therefore believed Sunday shoppers deserved to be shot at dawn. When we check the original statement, we find the deception is even worse. Tabernacles altered Kimball's meaning to the extent that an ellipsis would not suffice. Instead, it resorted to rearranging his words. Kimball's original read, quote, "The law is less severe now, and so regrettably is the community's attitude to these grave sins," close quote. What Kimball saw as regrettable was not, as Tabernacles would have it, that homosexuals aren't executed, but that society regards homosexual sin indulgently. This type of misrepresentation quickly erodes trust in any author purporting to do history. It's not a question of a different emphasis or alternate interpretation of the evidence. Instead, this is simply distortion in service of an ideology. Distorting Erastus Snow. So, as soon as I saw queering cite an 1878 address by Apostle Erastus Snow with ellipsis, I was immediately suspicious. Those suspicions proved well-founded. Queering wishes to use Snow as evidence that a, quote, "line of interpretation in the church depicting," close quote, "Adam as initially androgynous and unsexed," quote, "was not an aberration," close quote. In plainer terms, he wishes to argue that within the church there is a stream of thought that does not regard Adam as having a sex at his creation. This Airbud-esque loophole can then allegedly be used to argue against the importance of sex in Genesis, and thereby minimize or deny the eternal nature of biological sex for God's children and their actions before, during, and after this life. We will shortly explore these efforts in greater detail. Let us examine the entirety of Queering's citation of Snow's 1878 address. All omitted material is Queering's, and indicated by ellipses. Quote, "LDS Apostle Erastus Snow made an observation about the lack of distinction between male and female in the original creation by citing Genesis 5:20. Now his quote from Snow. The being we call man, but which in the language of these scriptures was called Adam, male and female created he them and called their name Adam, Gen 5:2, which in the original in which these scriptures were written by Moses signifies the first man. There was no effort at distinguishing between the one half and the other, and calling one man and the other woman. This was an after distinction, but the explanation of it is one man, one being, and he called their name Adam. But he created them male and female, for they were one, and he says not unto the woman multiply and unto the man multiply, but he says unto them, multiply and reproduce your species. He speaks unto them as belonging together, as constituting one being, and as organized in his image and likeness. 338 words are here omitted. One party says God is a man, and the other says he is a woman. I say he is both. He created man in the image of God, male and female created he them. He called their name Adam, which signifies in Hebrew the first man. So that the beings we call Adam and Eve were the first man placed here on this earth, and their name was Adam, and they were in the express image of God. Close citation from Snow, continuing with querying. Snow interprets Genesis 5:2, when the male and female are both called Adam, as referring to a singular intersex being. From this, Snow concludes, quote, deity consists of man and woman, close quote. Snow is not referring here to LDS teaching of a male god and a separate female god, but rather to a divine hybrid in a single god. He uses a singular masculine pronoun for God and Adam consistently in this speech. Then, just as this singular god is both male and female simultaneously, so is Adam originally male and female simultaneously. Snow describes this singular Adam as blended, or made of component parts. Snow's account depicts a genderqueer deity who creates the genderqueer Adam without calling them man or woman and making no effort at distinguishing between the one half and the other. As noted above, this reference to a primal androgyne has a long history in Jewish and Christian exegesis, and Snow applies it here to describe God in the LDS tradition as well. Pages 85 through 86, ellipses in the original, close quote from Quiring. Snow treated this matter in three talks, not the single one mentioned in Quiring. One that is unmentioned was also in 1878 and the other in 1885. Examining 1878 without ellipses. Quiring begins poorly by omitting vital context. Snow's talk began by describing the creedal God of Catholicism and Protestantism, quote, without body or parts, close quote. Snow's sentence immediately preceding the mention of Adam is a description of the human body. Quote, if we study physiology or anatomy, we are led to exclaim with the psalmist of old, I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and see a beautiful harmony in all the parts, and a most exquisite design. This is proven by an examination of the various parts of the human form, and every organ adapted to its special use and for its special purpose, and combining a whole, a grand union, a little kingdom composed of many kingdoms, united and constituting the grand whole, the being we call man, close quote. So even here, Quiring's tidy story of an androgynous, genderqueer humanity is questionable, when we read more of the talk. Snow is asking us to consider the present human form, which is clearly sexed and constitutes man, meaning humanity, male and female, not an androgynous being. It is profitable to consider Snow's 1878 words without the ellipses that Quiring uses. In the following excerpt from Snow's words, I use boldface to indicate the words that were excised in Quiring. These lengthy paragraphs are mostly to allow the reader to check the context and thrust of Snow's actual argument. I will discuss the excised bits one at a time, following the full text. The being we call man, but which in the language of these scriptures was called Adam, male and female created he them, and called their name Adam, which in the original in which these scriptures were written by Moses signifies the first man. There was no effort at distinguishing between the one half and the other, and calling one man and the other woman. This was an after distinction. But the explanation of it is, one man, one being, and he called their name Adam. But he created them male and female, for they were one. And he says not to the woman multiply, and to the man multiply, but he says unto them, multiply and reproduce your species and replenish the earth. he speaks unto them as belonging together, as constituting one being, and as organized in his image and after his likeness. Begin bold. And the Apostle Paul, treating upon this subject in the same way, says that man was created in the likeness of God and after the express image of his person. John the Apostle, in writing the history of Jesus, speaks in the same way, that Jesus was in the likeness of his Father and express image of his person. And if the revelations that God has made of himself to man agree and harmonize upon this theory, and if mankind would be more believing and accept the simple, plain, clear definition of deity and description of himself which he has given us, instead of hunting for some great mystery and seeking to find out God where he is not and as he is not, we all might understand him. There is no great mystery about it, no more mystery about it than there is about ourselves and our own relationship to our father and mother, and the relationship of our own children to us. That which we see before our eyes, and which we are experiencing from time to time, day to day, and year to year, is an exemplification of deity. What, says one, do you mean we should understand that deity consists of man and woman? Most certainly I do. If I believe anything that God has ever said about himself, and anything pertaining to the creation and organization of man upon the earth, I must believe that deity consists of man and woman. Now this is simplifying it down to our understanding, and the great Christian world will be ready to open their mouths and cry, blasphemy, sacrilege. Open wide their eyes and wide their mouths in utmost astonishment. What? God a man and woman? The Shakers say he was, and Ann Lee says, Christ came in the form of a man in the first place, and now comes in the form of a woman. And she was that form. And these Christians, they say he has no form, neither body parts nor passions. End bold. One party says he is a man, and the other says he is a woman. I say he is both. Bold. How do you know? I only repeat what he says of himself. End bold. That he created man in the image of God, male and female, created he them, and called their name Adam, which signifies in Hebrew the first man. So that the beings we call Adam and Eve were the first man placed here on this earth, and their name was Adam, and they were in the express image of God. Bold text. Now, if anybody is disposed to say that the woman is in the likeness of God and that the man was not, and if vice versa, I say you are both wrong, or else God has not told us the truth. Close quote. As mentioned, Snow is rebutting the creedal view of God as a mystery, a being without body parts or passions. He makes his point of view clear in the omitted material. Quote, there is no great mystery about it, no more mystery about it than there is about ourselves and our own relationship to our father and mother and the relationship of our own children to us, that which we see before our eyes and which we are experiencing from time to time, day to day, and year to year is an exemplification of deity. Close quote. In the excised material, Snow teaches that humanity is in the image of God in precisely the same way as children are in the image of earthly parents. Our own mortal experience of parents and children mirrors God's experience with us. This is not androgynous or unsexed. Queering tells us that, quote, Snow is not referring here to LDS teachings of a male God and a separate female God, but rather to a divine hybrid in a single God, close quote, page 85. But this is nonsense. Snow is doing precisely what Queering claims he is not doing. Human parents are clearly separate, are clearly two individuals, and clearly sexed. Snow tells us that women and men are both in the image of God in that sense. Later in the 1878 talk, Snow says that Satan wishes to possess, quote, the tabernacles, bodies, of Adam, which means a man and his wife, male and female, whom he called Adam, and rule the earth, close quote. For Snow, Adam is explicitly a man and his wife, with two separate physically sexed bodies, which demonic powers wish to control. Contra Queering, Adam is not an androgynous proto-being that will only later be sexed. Snow references Darwin's explanation for, quote, the present order of beings we call man, close quote. The plural present-day beings are here, too, referred to by the singular man. Furthermore, Snow demonstrates his use of the singular man in situations that indisputably involved sexed men and women when he writes, quote, this being we call man is only God in embryo, And Moses tells us that the Creator conversed with this man whom he called Adam, consisting of male and female. He conversed with them, showing himself to them, spoke with them at different times, gave them instructions, gave them his law, visited them repeatedly in their new home, in the place we call the Garden of Eden, the garden that the Lord planted for man eastward in Eden. Close quote. It is clear then that Adam, in other words humanity, is being used by Snow for both male Adam and female Eve, not as reference to a single androgynous being. Does Snow give us any further hints as to how he sees this? Indeed he does. Only one sentence after the quoted section, but we will not learn it from querying. Quote, I sometimes illustrate this matter by taking up a pair of shears. You all know they are composed of two halves, but they are necessarily parts, one of another. And to perform their work for each other, as designed, they belong together, and neither one of them is fitted for the accomplishment of the works alone. And for this reason, says St. Paul, the man is not without the woman, nor the woman without the man in the Lord. In other words, there can be no God except he is composed of the man and woman united. And there is not in all the eternities that exist, nor ever will be, a God in any other way. Close quote. A pair of scissors has two blades that work in unity. They work together, meshing, and are part of a larger whole. But there is no genderqueer gobbledygook here. There can be no God except he is composed of the man and woman united. There never will be a God in any other way. Perhaps even this is not clear enough. I have another description, continues Snow, quote, there never was a God, and there never will be in all eternities, except they are made of these two component parts, a man and a woman, the male and the female, close quote. The term God, for Snow, is not the single androgynous being of queer theory's fever dreams. God does not consist of an amorphous blend of male and female essence or potential. God is a man and a woman. Despite Queering's distortions, Snow certainly is, quote, referring here to LDS teachings of a male God and a separate female God, close quote, and not at all to, quote, a divine hybrid in a single God, close quote. When Snow says that, quote, deity consists in man and woman, close quote, it is simply indefensible to read him as Queering does, if historical standards mean anything. Queering says that, quote, Snow describes this singular Adam as blended and made of component parts, close quote. In another affront to scholarly norms, those terms are misused as they become bereft of their context. Consider Snow's discussion of mortal death as he compares it to a male and female participant in godhood. Quote, as I said, man was created male and female, and two principles are blended in one. And the man is not without the woman, nor the woman without the man in the Lord. And there is no Lord, there is no God, in which the two principles are not blended, nor can be. And we may never hope to attain unto the eternal power and the Godhead upon any other principle. Not only so, but this Godhead, composing two parts, male and female, is also composed of two elements, spiritual and temporal. Or in other words, two organisms, the one capable of dwelling within the other, the spirit dwelling within the outer tabernacle, answering to the spirit what our clothing answers to this body, as a covering and a shield and protection. The spirit teaches the tabernacle, and the spirit makes use of the tabernacle. When once it finds itself embodied in this tabernacle, it begins to use the fingers and hands of the tabernacle and makes these its servants. The moment it is separated, this tabernacle lies senseless. It cannot set itself in motion. It cannot keep itself in motion. It is the spirit that does all this. Close quote. Godhood requires both spiritual, the spirit, and temporal, the physical bodies. These are two separate things that work in close unity, quote, one capable of dwelling within the other, close quote. But it is senseless to read this as Snow saying that the spirit and body are entirely the same thing or undifferentiated. There is a tight union, just as Paul requires a blend of man and woman for the Christian life. But Paul is not talking about an androgynous primordial Adam, nor a single being with male and female essences blended, and neither is Snow. Time, continues Snow, is, quote, a term used in reference to the short period belonging to mortality, while eternity is used in the measure of the time of the gods. But this course of being, one eternal round, is marvelous in our eyes, and who can comprehend it? But we see, yes, we see right before us today, his image, man, male, and female. Snow summarizes all this by saying, quote, "As I said, a union of two principles, the refined element that is organized into spirit and the grosser element we call tabernacle, organized as an outer clothing, the two united and blended together, and the two principles, male and female, united. And for what purpose? Why, we see here for the purpose of procreation, for the purpose of endless increase, and the building up, and enlarging, and extending the kingdoms and dominions of eternity. Else, why are all these vast creations the shining orbs that indicate to feeble man on this lower earth the existence of these glorified worlds? Why all this, if there were not the works of the gods of eternity going on, and that continually?" Close quote. For Snow, the blending of male and female is about procreation, another not inconsequential detail left out by Quiring. This is as far from its primal androgyne, or being male and female simultaneously, as you can get. Snow even uses an analogy that makes explicit mention of male and female parents and children, quote, "And we may say to every child, though there are fathers many and mothers many, but to you there is but one. Honor your father and your mother, and let your father and mother honor their father and mother. And this is the chain of the priesthood, and power let down from the eternities to man on the earth. And may God enable us to grow in this chain and climb higher and higher, onward and upward, and work ourselves up to the eternal power and Godhead. God is enlarging and extending his dominions. He is multiplying his kingdoms and his offsprings, over which he is extending his benign influence and blessings and glory and honor forever and ever. The divine purpose is to gather out men and women and locate and organize them and classify them together and instruct them and lead them on and inspire them with faith and build them up and teach them the laws of life and health and lift them up that they may exercise faith and lay hold upon the promises of God and climb up upon this chain that is laid down from the gods of eternity to their children on earth." Close quote. Even as the 1878 talk stands, Quiring has grossly misread and misrepresented it. It is difficult to be this wrong by accident. A talk from 1885. Having seen how much additional text has been stripped away from Snow and how his meaning has been twisted beyond recognition, let's reflect on the duties of a serious historian. A decent historian helps contextualize a speaker's remarks. So says the American Historical Association. A decent historian then would perhaps question if Snow had spoken on the same topic elsewhere. Though Quiring does not mention it, there is an 1885 talk that further contradicts the ideas imputed to Erastus Snow. Quote, "So when the Father said unto his Son in the beginning, let us make man in our image and after our likeness, it conveys to us the idea that man was organized in the same form and general appearance of both the Father and the Son. This especially in relation to the man himself, for you will remark the wording of the text which we have read, in the image of God created he him, referring to Adam, male and female created he them. You will perceive a difference in the language in regard to the creation of females. Now it is not said in so many words in the scriptures that we have a mother in heaven as well as a father. It is left for us to infer this from what we see and know of all living things in the earth, including man. The male and female principle is united and both necessary to the accomplishment of the object of their being. And if this is not the case with our Father in heaven, after whose image we are created, then it is an anomaly in nature. But to our minds, the idea of a father suggests that of a mother. As one of our poets says, in the heavens are parents single. No, the thought makes reason stare. Truth is reason. Truth eternal tells me I have a mother there." Close quote. It seems unfair that we weren't shown this talk. As we've just seen, Quiring's claims about the 1878 talk is mostly bluster. Quote, "Snow is not referring here to LDS teachings of a male god and a separate female god, but rather to a divine hybrid in a single god." Close quote, page 85. But as can easily be seen, Snow precisely and unequivocally taught in 1885 about two separate divine beings, one of each sex. He refers, in fact, to Eliza R. Snow's "O My Father," a very explicit articulation of the idea. It turns out that Quiring has cited some bits of Snow's 1878 talk, which can be warped if one excludes enough of it, while not even disclosing that the 1885 one exists. Quote, Hence, when it is said that God created our first parents in his likeness, in the image of God created he him, male and female created he them, it is intimated in language sufficiently plain to my understanding that the male and female principle was present with the gods as it is with man. It needs only a common understanding of the organism of man and all living creatures, and the functions of this organism, to show the primary object of the Creator, and that is the multiplication of the species, the fulfillment of the commandment given to multiply and replenish the earth, given to both man and beast. We need only to study the anatomy and construction of the human system, and to understand its powers and capabilities, to comprehend the object and purpose of the Creator. Close quote. We see again male and female plural gods, the physical bodies of living things, and the emphasis on reproduction. All of this may be, quote, in language sufficiently plain, close quote, to Snow's understanding and any reader not blinded by queer theory, but it will escape queering's readers because they have not been given the necessary facts. For Snow, humans, animals, and gods are all sexed, and the purpose of that sex is, quote, the multiplication of the species, to multiply and replenish the earth, close quote, via, quote, the anatomy of the human system with its powers and capabilities, close quote. As in 1878 for Snow, this is all ultimately about procreation, not gender fluidity. A second talk from 1878. A competent historian thus needs to consider all the speaker's other statements. In the present case, this duty extends to a third instance of Snow treating the same ideas in terms fatal to Queering's ahistorical reading. In a talk given only about a month before the 1878 address vivisected by Queering, Snow said, quote, "We must believe that man is made in the image of God, and consequently that we are the same species as the gods. However childlike and feeble we are in this condition of mortality, we are nevertheless descended from the gods, made in their image and after their likeness. The fathers have told us we have descended from the gods." Queering's, quote, "singular God who is both male and female simultaneously," close quote, is again nowhere to be found. Gods is plural. Snow goes on to insist that the divine we means others were involved in the creation, quote, "and that when God said to his associates, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness,' he was not alone. And as Paul said, there are gods many and lords many, but so far as we are concerned, there is given to us one God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ," close quote. Further, Snow says that Jesus, quote, "was in the likeness of his Father and the express image of his person. And the accounts we have of Jesus represent him as being physically and in all essential parts in the likeness of man, that he ate and drank and partook of the elements that enter into the composition of our earthly tabernacle. Otherwise, there was, so far as his person and outward appearance was concerned, no essential difference between him and Adam's race generally." Close quote. Queering is a work of poor or dishonest history. The 1885 talk confirms beyond doubt that Queering has misrepresented Snow's thoughts, unless we are to believe the apostle changed his mind between 1878 and 1885. That is implausible on three grounds. One, Snow's meaning in 1878 is not what Queering claims, as I've demonstrated. Two, the 1878 and 1885 talks use the same terms, expressions, and scriptures to discuss the same topic. The 1885 address is a recapitulation of the materials and teachings Snow used in 1878. And, three, the second unmentioned 1878 talk predates the cited one, proving that Snow's thoughts have followed a consistent line throughout, both before and after the 1878 address twisted in Queering. It is hard to imagine a more ironclad historical demonstration that Queering's reading is tendentious. After this disaster of interpretation and representation, it is worth asking, is Erastus Snow the best one can offer? It appears the author sought any scrap that would be twisted or deformed into a queer shape if one squints and doesn't look too closely. The bankruptcy of its treatment of Snow is compelling evidence that the author can find or manufacture nothing better. Someone less ideologically driven would have faced and reported the facts squarely. As the American Historical Association warns, quote, "The desire to score points as an advocate should never tempt a historian to represent the historical record or the critical methods that the profession uses to interpret that record," close quote. quote, this book looks to the LDS tradition, close quote, we are told, quote, as a resource of undoing gender and sexuality by revealing the lack of a coherent heterosexuality or heterogender in the tradition itself, close quote, from page 160-161. This is a historical claim that the tradition is not coherent in some way, which is to say that certain facts about it are true or not true. And that requires reading texts and interpreting them. To claim there is a lack of coherency on these points explicitly commits querying to representing the texts fully and fairly to argue for their incoherency. The author cannot simply give an incomplete account of Snow's thought and then claim mission accomplished. There simply is no convincing way to read Snow's statements in their full context and conclude that they support Quirin's account. Either this is lying to the reader, or the author is a poor reader indeed. Part 2. What is the point? Wise readers might simply stop here, and they have heard enough to see where this is going. Only camera tricks can make Air Bud into Michael Jordan. Still, those who cannot turn away, drawn by the horrible fascination of a plane wreck or So Bad It's Good movie, might wonder what all this is in aid of. Performativity and queering. One prominent queer theorist is Judith Butler, and queering's debt to her is clear. Pages 4 through 5, 15, 19 through 20, 61 through 62, 124, 25, 130, 142, 158. Butler's main idea, wrote Martha Nussbaum, quote, first introduced in Gender Trouble in 1989 and repeated throughout her books, is that gender is a social artifice. Our ideas of what women and men are reflect nothing that exists eternally in nature. Instead, they derive from customs that embed social relations of power. Close quote. Quote, Butler emphasizes performance as an analytical category that also allows for radical political and critical intervention. Butler suggests that all identities, gendered and sexual in particular, are forms of scripted performance that are always available for subversive reinterpretation, close quote. This subversive reinterpretation gets at what is meant by queering, evidence of queer theory's inextricable link to politics and advocacy. Quote, to queer becomes an act by which stable boundaries of sexual identity are transgressed, reversed, mimicked, or otherwise critiqued. Queering can be enacted on behalf of all non-normative sexualities and identities as well, all that is considered by the dominant paradigms of culture to be alien, strange, unfamiliar, transgressive, odd, in short, queer. Despite its postmodern cachet, this approach is hardly new. It is a new cut of an old design, described by Isaiah as putting darkness for light and light for darkness, bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter, Isaiah 5:20. Queering and parody. To queer the Mormon cosmos, then, is a sort of parody in service of a political project. Quote, not surprisingly, postmodernism and queer theory and practice share both a theoretical base and artistic techniques, irony and parody, close quote. In one sense, therefore, we could decide that it is pointless to review a parody. A parody and its irony are not to be taken seriously, and any distortions, exaggerations, or misrepresentations are part of the fun, though they may have a serious point to make. It would be obtuse to review Jonathan Swift's devastating satire of English policy toward Ireland by indignantly pointing out that no one in the English government was truly urging cannibalism. Then again, being an altogether more skilled writer fighting for a better cause, Swift didn't need to stoop to misrepresenting texts to make it appear as if the government actually did say so. As we've already seen, queering is not a parody in that sense. It retains all the outward dress of an academic undertaking. For example, it quotes Erastus Snow and then argues that his words demonstrate a stream of androgyny in the concept of God and humanity. If the reader is supposed to catch that all this is just a bit of exaggerated fun, it is probably too subtle. The disguised weaknesses of queer tactics are, in some ways, parodic of scholarship, but that is unlikely to be what the author is aiming for. Quote, this isn't a matter of making queer theory compatible or reconciled with Latter-day Saint thought, close quote, we are told. Quote, rather, it is a method or approach that may be taken to any system, including Latter-day Saint thought, close quote. Petrie explicitly states that the book's goal is to show that, quote, In a delightfully perverse way, Mormonism could be a central example in a queer religious imagery, close quote. The end goal is to invert, send up, or undermine its source. The plan is subversive, in Judith Butler's sense, to deconstruct and destabilize in support of what is ultimately a political undertaking. As Queering puts it, quote, "The emphasis here on queering religion as a destabilizing verb rather than an adjective suggests that there is not only an active role on the part of the interpreter, but also no essence to a tradition, only its interpretation. This is not a reclamation, but a resignification," close quote. Thus, Queering wants to appropriate church symbols, history, and doctrine and turn them to its own ends. Quote, "Judith Butler's concept of resignification refers to the process of reinterpreting and reusing existing language, symbols, and cultural norms in order to challenge and subvert their traditional meanings. Not only does the project of redescription engage at the level of language and the possible, but such possibilities are already present," close quote. If the desire, though, is simply to appropriate symbols, not to reclaim, but to resignify, and not to argue for any compatibility or reconciliation, why does Rasta Snow need to be misrepresented? What does it matter what any church leader, member, or text said about anything? It matters because the point of deconstruction is to weaken and call into doubt texts and the ideas upon which they are based. It is disingenuous to imply that one is only exploring possibilities. The whole point of deconstruction in queer theory is destabilization. As Searle observed, deconstruction attempts to set up shop in the microscopic cracks and interstices of the text, the simple words supposedly freighted with hidden meaning, and the text's, quote, "marginal features," close quote. The industrious queer theorist is thus always on the lookout for these toeholds and pry points, imaginary or otherwise. The intent is to expose, quote, "the inconsistencies and possibilities embedded within the tradition," close quote. Quote, "Rather than starting from the normative system, queer theory then looks to what is repressed or ignored for clues about where to begin any analysis," close quote. This doesn't happen with Erastus Snow. We aren't shown what Snow ignores or represses. Instead, we're told what he is supposedly saying overtly, even when it turns out he isn't saying it. The only things ignored or repressed are the sections from Snow that Queering leaves safely unmentioned. Quote, "These projects often blur the boundaries between properly constructed historical analysis and constructive theology," close quote. But doesn't properly constructed historical analysis require at the very least that we not misrepresent our sources? There are ground rules of historical analysis, no matter how logocentric a committed postmodernist might regard them, that historians need to observe if they are going to drape their work in that idiom. After all, Queering asserts, quote, "The sources that I use to analyze these questions are largely the conventional, even canonical ones. These voices are neither as stable nor as inhospitable to queer analysis as they might hope to be," close quote. Note well, this is a historical claim, that the sources really are saying some things somewhere that really are hospitable to Queering's worldview. Queering clearly wants to have it both ways. It is steeped in postmodernism, which at times even insists that the meaning that texts have is only created by readers as they encounter the text. We see this when it says there is, quote, "no essence to a tradition, only its interpretation," close quote. Yet it also implicitly wants us to conclude that the text truly means something helpful to its political project, and that this somehow proves something. We're told this approach is a means of thinking through issues. But if I must mislead you to get you to think, you might join postmodernists in suspecting that my discourse is about manipulation and power, not truth or genuine thought. Queer theory seeks to undo gender and sexuality, vital and treasured absolutes in the worldview of believing church members, using postmodern tools founded on the stance that discourse is about power. And power is a zero-sum game in queer theory's telling. So, let us have no nonsense about this being a benevolent or neutral exercise. But is it a historically or textually supported exercise? If so, then its motives do not matter. If not, we can then return to the motives to understand why it stumbles so badly. Part 3. God, Adam, and Genesis. We will now examine Quirin's approach to scriptural texts. We consider three cases. 1. An attempt to make the Godhead genderqueer and homoerotic. 2. An attempt to undermine the Church's reading of creation. The abuse of Erastus Snow's talk was part of this effort, as demonstrated in Part 1. 3. An attempt to make Adam androgynous, only later separated into male and female. Part 1 has likewise already seen Snow as an unwilling participant in this undertaking. Case 1. A genderqueer Godhead. Given that an embodied sex god is foundational to Latter-day Saint thought, page 28, destabilizing that view is Quirin's first task. Quote, there is much more ambiguity and fluidity of gender and sexuality in LDS narratives about the Godhead than has been previously recognized, close quote. Again, we have a textual historical claim. Given that the Church rejects the divine essence oneness of the creedal God of Trinitarianism, Quirin tells us, quote, divine unity is rooted in solidarity, covenant, and relationship. This notion of divine love, then, fully open and expansive in its variety, not only is the basis for the Mormon challenge to Trinitarian ontology, but also may be the very basis of a queer approach to a projectionist Godhead. The ideal relationship in cisgender male-female marriage is difficult to distinguish from the relationship between the male members of the Godhead in LDS teaching. The metaphysics of oneness and unity of purpose describe the covenant relationship between both husband and wife and between the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The Godhead is explicitly invoked in relationship to male-female marriage. Quote. So far, so good. The querying soon follows. Given the desire of Jesus that his followers be one, as he and the Father are one, John 17:21, we are told, quote, all relationships should follow this model, seeing divine love between same-sex partners in the Godhead as the archetype for heterosexual love also reverses the foundations. Same-sex love is not a perverse counterfeit of mixed-sex love, but rather both draw on the same principles of unity, commitment, and effort to achieve oneness, close quote. This is an enormous leap. Does anyone really fall for such rhetorical tricks if they don't start out wanting to be fooled? Let's examine the problems with it. First, the argument relies on the fallacy of equivocation regarding all love as the same, when in fact there are many kinds of love, e.g. charity, brotherly love, and parental love, which are desirable but not sexualized, versus marital love, which is. Second, to describe the Godhead as same-sex partners misrepresents the doctrine. Certainly the Godhead are partners in a certain sense, but not in a sexual one. However, as the term inevitably implies to a 21st century reader, rather than same-sex love, the archetype is familial love between father and son. Unfortunately for queering, that entails heterosexual families and reproduction. Third, the saints have never regarded same-sex love as anything but an ideal, if it means two people of the same sex with love for each other. It is when that love is combined with sexual desires and acts that the problem arises. We note that Quirin talks about, quote, unity, commitment, and effort to achieve oneness, close quote, which were never the problem. We're told that it is, quote, difficult to distinguish, close quote, between a male-female marriage and the relationship of the father and son. It isn't. For one, the former properly includes sexuality and reproduction, the latter does not because it is parental. For Latter-day Saints, the parent-child relationship between father and son is not a metaphor. It instead describes their relationship as literally as it does that of John Adams and John Quincy Adams. It is strange, but evidently necessary, to have to spell out that parent-child incest as either corrupt symbol or horrific literal reality has nothing of the holy or divine about it. This is certainly true in the Latter-day Saint cosmos, and would be true in virtually any human society not afflicted with queer theorists. Use of that kind of subtext is troubling, to say the least. Beyond parody. Still, the text will not remain sub for long. Quirin quotes Latter-day Saint philosopher Blake Osler, quote, Blake Osler's description of the all-male Godhead, for instance, holds some resources for imagining this divine unit among these men. So, quote, it is the relationship of the other that inspires the divinity in the divine persons, for they are divine because they love with a self-giving love, so that they are one in each other. What distinguishes the Mormon view most from the conventional tradition is that the divine nature is possessed by more than one instance of that nature and is shared with others through a freely chosen relationship of indwelling love, quote, quote, and subquote. It was here that I realized that queer theory is truly beyond parody. Quote, the homoeroticism here describes long-standing LDS views on the Godhead. Osler frequently uses language to describe this divine love as penetration, indwelling, inside, in, and opening. He explains, they actually are one in each other. The intelligence, knowledge, power, light, truth, or life that proceeds from God's presence is like a spiritual force field that penetrates into each of the divine persons and imparts the same spiritual energy and life to each of the divine persons. Drawing on the Gospel of John to make this point, as Osler does for divine love, is also significant since this Gospel has a man whom Jesus loves at the center of its story, replete with homoerotic themes. Page 33, emphasis added, close quote. Difficult as it is to believe, queering takes Osler and Jesus' love for a disciple as grist for the homoerotic mill the author is attempting to build. Osler said penetrating and indwelling to describe the oneness of the Godhead, and in queer theory, that's all it takes to be off and running. This has all the intellectual sophistication and insight of preteen boys sniggering when someone says butt or underwear. Osler also joins Snow and Kimball as an author whose meaning has been twisted by omission. Just prior to the sentence quoted, Osler makes his meaning clear. Quote, the divine persons exist in a unity that includes loving, interpenetrating, and intersubjective awareness of another. Close quote. Authors simply can't protect themselves from a reader so determined to be so wrong. Quote, being misunderstood is one thing, being willfully misunderstood quite another. Close quote. As one commentator wrote of a similar querying to create a homosexual divinity, this is, quote, the worst kind of literalism, close quote. Querying gets worse. Quote, the interpenetrative love shared here, DNC 35.2, between three men, which makes them one, flesh, question mark, in one another, calls into question the heteronormative logic of the divine realm in Mormon thought. Further, this passage notes that it is through this love that kinship with God is formed, that they may become the sons of God. Kinship here is not merely a biological relation, but a relationship of becoming formed intentionally and through practice. The Father and the Son are equally one in one another, and a disciple joins their homoerotic fellowship by sharing their unity with them and with others. Close quote. This is a spectacular example of deconstructionist tactics. Here a supposedly significant and revealed word from the first misrepresented text, Osler, is used to distort a second, the Doctrine of Covenants. Once again, it seems sadly necessary to point out that becoming a redeemed son through adoption ought not to involve parent-child incest any more than Jesus' literal sonship does. Coyly sneaking flesh between parentheses doesn't change this. In short, hearing interpenetrating love, or father and son, and thinking homoeroticism may tell us a great deal about the author and his method, but nothing useful about the text, church theology, or the thought of Osler or anyone else. It is disturbing to see father-son love reflexively and repeatedly read in sexual terms. But even this supposed homosexual subtext cannot be permitted by querying to imply masculinity or fixed sexual gender categories. We will forego a detailed discussion of the incoherence of seeing same-sex eroticism while denying the fixity and reality of biological sex. Quote, the notion of interpenetration is a point to critically evaluate. All this phallocentric description of God's presence as a force that penetrates in order to impart life into other divine persons belongs to a specifically masculine-gendered metaphysics. The homoerotic elements of this relationship need not be occasion to reinstall androcentrism, gender essentialism, or even the phallocentrism of the penetrative logic inness of love. Love, it seems, is meant to unite, not divide. A reformulation of such imagery while preserving the notion that love accommodates otherness is one resource for thinking about how all kinds of bodies, persons, subjectivities, and identities may be incorporated into LDS articulations of deity. The analysis of the Godhead as an idealized same-sex relationship need not reify the notion of maleness and femaleness as an unreconstructed binary, close quote. We are once again struck by the realization that if this is the best the author can offer, critically evaluate seems mighty generous. The evidence really is overwhelmingly against him. It all reads like a bad joke. Osler argues that, quote, the divine persons are essentially related to each other in a genetic sense as members of the same divine family. Jesus is the Father's Son, the perfect reflection of the Father's likeness and image, because he is begotten as issue of the Father, close quote. Quirine takes the same material and incredibly concludes, quote, the very insistence that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are male produces an acutely homoerotic scene of divine love, close quote. If the reader finds this consistent with any sort of legitimate intellectual or historical methodology, or at all insightful, illuminating, persuasive, or honest, I simply cannot help him. If you truly believe a dog can shoot free throws, well-reasoned argument won't get far. But reason and logic are logocentric, and so targets of queer theory as well. Does God have a body or a sex? Most non-LDS commentaries see God as unembodied or unsexed in Genesis, albeit with some potential ambiguity in the background, as the Yale Anchor Bible discusses. Quote, in this crescendo of the poem, God's creation of Adam in his image is now shown to include the human duality of sex and gender, which yet still corresponds to the image of God. The meanings of these parallel phrases and concepts are not explicitly articulated, leaving a residue of ambiguity regarding how the human duality of male and female articulates the image of God. God in Genesis 1 does not have sexual features, but these differential qualities, human and divine, male and female, unity and duality, are here interrelated. The human's ability to reproduce, involving their sexual complementarity as male and female, is entailed in their creation in God's image. The text may be reticent for good reason, perhaps because of the topics of God's body and sexuality, but the implications of this text go beyond simple obscurity, close quote. Others see the text more strongly against God having a sex and or a body. That said, there are some that insist on God's corporeality and his maleness. Quote, does the image of God refer primarily to the spiritual nature or to the bodily form of man? The idea of a corporeal resemblance seems free from objection on the level of Old Testament theology, and it is certainly strongly suggested. God is expressly said to have a form which can be seen, and that they ever advanced to the conception of God as formless spirit would be difficult to prove. Without question, in the broader background of this Genesis 1 statement about God's image in man, there is the notion of Yahweh's human form. A closer look reveals that Genesis 1 does mean that humans were made in the bodily image of God. God had the human bodily form first. Humans did not project it onto God. God made humans, men and women, in the image and likeness that God already had. We may not share the text's assumption that God has a human form, but the Bible's first description of human beings asserts that we were created, male and female, in the bodily image of God. We bear God's form not first in our brains, spirits, or souls, but in our entire male and female embodied selves. Sex is included in this. This is already implicit in how Genesis goes out of its way to affirm that both men and women were made in God's image. Here, male and female bodies are both godlike and sexual, and there is no contradiction between the two. We moderns can no longer assume, as the text's authors did, that God had a body. The Bible itself emphasizes this idea much less than many texts of its time. And even Genesis 1, in shifting to plural language at the crucial point, let us make humanity in our image, averts its eyes from God's body. The focus is not on God's body. That is assumed. Instead, the focus of this text is on the creation of male and female embodied humans as the climax of creation and the extension of God's power and blessing. Close quote. There is thus more support for the Latter-day Saints than Quirin concedes, and certainly more support than queering has successfully conjured for itself. Opinion may be divided about God's sex and body, but an incestuous, homoerotic, genderqueer trinity is pure fantasy, and a distasteful one at that. Case number two, the creation. There are at least four creation accounts recognized in the Church: Genesis, Moses, Abraham, and the Temple Endowment. Queering claims that, quote, it should be clear that the temple rites do not resolve these interpretive issues by providing some fixed point, nor should these private rites play a role in the public interpretation of Genesis 1 through 3 as found in the proclamation. Rather, the temple version of the creation is one more alternative that adds instability to the interpretive tradition, close quote. This conclusion is anything but clear. Joseph Fielding Smith, for example, evidently saw the temple as uniquely normative. Of Genesis, Moses, and the temple, he wrote, quote, I think the temple account, which was given by Revelation, is the clearest of all these, close quote. I think most saints see it thus. In any case, Quirin benefits from the fact that most church members will not engage in public discussion or disputation about the temple endowment, quote, it is a sacred rite, and recipients covenant not to discuss it publicly. While there is room for interpretation about what specific parts of the ceremony must not be disclosed, devotees and many scholars tend to err on the side of caution. There are some important gender critiques of the ritual, yet exegesis of the ritual is complicated not only because it is a sacred secret rite, but because the rite as text is unstable. The endowment ritual has undergone revisions, most recently in 1990 and again in 2018. Changes include gendered pronouns and significant changes in gendered covenants. For these reasons, I leave it out of my analysis of LDS interpretations of Genesis 1 through 3 here, close quote. And given the interpretive fantasies of an interpenetrative homoerotic godhead to which readers have already been witness, they can heave a trembling sigh of relief to hear that the author will not subject the temple to similar distortion. No changes to the temple ritual affect the teaching of a literally sexed godhead or humanity, despite an attempt to imply it. Perhaps the postmodern quest for hidden subtext was stealing over me, but by this point I began to suspect that if the temple was more amenable to distortion, it would not have been spared. The family, a proclamation to the world. Queering is particularly keen to deconstruct Latter-day Saint readings of the creation, since Genesis is used in the family, a proclamation to the world. Quote, however, few have analyzed the source text and scripture alluded to in the proclamation. Does the text of Genesis and the various LDS canonical iterations of Genesis support the interpretation of the proclamation that Adam and Eve as archetypes of fixed binary gender identity, roles, and heterosexuality? In all cases, I argue that the text and its interpretive history do not preclude gender and sexual fluidity, close quote. As before, we see that the intent is not a simple repurposing of the symbolism or doctrine to describe a different cognitive world. Instead, we have what might be called a historical textual approach, a claim that foundational texts do not mean what the Church and its leaders claim they mean. And the clear goal is to delegitimize the Church's articulation of its doctrine. This is not a benign endeavor. Incompatible? Queering declares the four accounts contradictory or incompatible, and there are certainly ways in which they could be thus read. We must not ignore, however, that the saints have overwhelmingly tended to view them as complementary, with the temple seen as the best and most authoritative account, with all others read in its light. Even if there were ways of reading Genesis in isolation that supported a rejection, by queer theory, of heterosexuality and binary gender, church members would not have read it that way when the temple taught otherwise. It is difficult to see how the most sacred, important rites would not have always been uniquely authoritative. I certainly know of no case in which a church leader says otherwise. Why does it matter? Because Queering wishes to deconstruct the orthodox ways of reading Genesis in part through appeals to historical critical claims about the Genesis text, while claiming that even the temple cannot save the orthodox interpretation. The postmodern credentials of this undertaking are a bit shaky. The only reason to quote the Bible and claim that the Church's reading is wrong or unstable is because the Bible is seen as normative in some way. It is a text with authority about what one ought to do or believe. And that requires an author, B. be it God or human, with a point of view that can be discerned and understood. A queer theory that appeals to the proper exegesis of the Bible, or the claim that their opponents have misread the Bible, is sneaking the author and his intentionality through the back door. Either that, or the appeal is pure power play, a cynical effort to manipulate. It has long been recognized that the upshot of such efforts, and likely not an incidental one, is that deconstructionists, quote, effectively strip the Bible of any stable meaning so that it cannot state a fact, issue a command, or make a promise. By extension, the same logic applies to Latter-day Saint scriptures, temple worship, and leaders. Furthermore, without the author to serve as touchstone of the distinction between meaning and significance, every interpretation becomes just as authorized a version as another. A text that cannot be set over against its commentary is no authority at all. Finally, biblical authority is undermined by the instability of meaning because, if nothing specific is said, the text cannot call for any specific response. Interpreters can give neither obedience nor belief to texts that lack specificity. If there is no meaning in the text, then there is nothing to which a reader can be held accountable. Close quote. As we will now see, even if we follow queering and eliminate the temple's vital interpretive role from consideration, its reading of Genesis is dubious. Queering uses the tropes and style of an academic historical, we can actually read texts and be better or worse at getting at what they mean, approach. If it is sincere in this undertaking, then its approach can be evaluated and critiqued. If it is insincere, merely putting on a show of critical assessment to disguise an infinite regress of textual play or a determined ideological advocacy drenched in eisegesis, then it is not to be trusted. It promises, quote, a close reading of the text, close quote. We will assume it means what it says and engage on those terms. Genesis and genre. Many have pointed out that different texts have different expectations and conventions that control how they are written and read. In a word, genre. Queering largely ignores this aspect of the text and instead engages in queer hermeneutics. Jan Fokelman argued passionately for an appreciation of genre and the coherence of the biblical text as it now stands. Quote, how often do we hear that there is contradiction in the text, or that there is a tension that must be a trace of a complex genetical process, or that there is too much repetition, another sure sign that more than one writer has worked on the text? And as soon as one encounters a textual seam, a doubling, or locus of tension, one is supposed to stop listening and to forge a hypothesis about the background of the text, the intention of the author, and especially about its origins, growth, and redactional reworkings, quote, quote. Queer theory is obsessed with these textual seams and points of tension. The heritage of deconstruction's focus on the marginal features of the text. In this case, that approach reflects a particularly naive, tone-deaf approach to the Bible, because its genre and narrative style use just such traits to communicate meaning. Quote, no precise designation for narratives has been agreed upon. Saga, legend, myth, folktale, etiology, story, and theological narrative have all been candidates. The designation story, or story of the past, is perhaps most helpful in determining how these materials functioned, close quote. They, quote, express a people's understanding of reality, not simply of facts, but of the inner meaning of those facts, close quote. Quote, like many ancient creation myths, this familiar story is more a mythic description of the dynamics of present human life than an attempt to reconstruct early history, close quote, writes one. This will be no surprise to temple-going members, who there experience a ritual drama that uses creation to articulate their own past, present, and future. Genesis 2, in particular, is written, quote, in the fashion of narrative literary forms, close quote. There are certainly saints who have read Genesis and parallel texts as literalistic history. But if queering is going to appeal to the text, it must be read in its genre, and not in one mistakenly imputed to it. To willfully violate what one author has called the covenant between communicator and listener as regards genre is to assure misunderstanding. One dictionary of the Old Testament agrees, quote, one of narrative criticism's most significant contributions has been the discovery and description of the distinctive character of Hebrew narrative. Diverse cultures do not tell stories in the same way. The fact would seem obvious, but in practice, the chasm between the conventions encoded in biblical narrative and those that configure Western literary tradition has not been readily apparent. Hebrew narrative is marked by its distinctive appreciation for symmetry, expressed most often through myriad forms of repetition. Repetition of vocabulary, grammatical structures, events, or images unites diverse events and signals their common import. Close quote. If queering is going to appeal to historical critical data, the failure to grapple with genre is one of its historical missteps, with significant consequences. Genesis. Two accounts. One of the earliest conclusions of Old Testament textual critics was that Genesis contains two creation accounts. Queering assumes that view, which serves the postmodern approach to texts very well. It provides another opportunity to claim that the accounts do not all say the same thing. Quote, the account of the creation of human beings in the first creation story of Genesis 1 through 2, 4a, is significantly different from the one in Genesis 2, 4b to 3. Close quote. Queering adopts the standard documentary hypothesis approach to the text. Quote, this problem is well known and may be explained by identifying different sources behind the final text, the priestly source for Genesis 1 and the Yahwist source for Genesis 2 through 3. The differences between them are instructive for the question of how to think about the place of sexual difference in these creation accounts. Close quote. The author will later be more blunt, labeling them contradictory stories. This tiny division of the creation into disparate sources that fundamentally disagree has, however, come under sustained attack for decades. It can no longer be assumed as the default critical position. A 2005 dissertation noted, quote, it was so easy to affirm a diversity of sources through genre or content that the possibility of an editor or author who saw them as interconnected was essentially dismissed. Close quote. Quote, we should not speak of a second parallel story of creation, close quote, wrote Walter Brueggemann. Quote, rather, Genesis 2 is a more intense reflection upon the implications of creation for the destiny of humanity, close quote. Many authors have emphasized that, regardless of the sources used, the author of Genesis has placed the two accounts together in the final text. Whereas early source critics saw this as a patchwork approach, where disparate and even contradictory sources were simply preserved side by side, many modern exegetes insist that the author saw no contradiction or inconsistency between them. Quote, the exact shaping power we find in chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis renders it highly probable that the final authors were conscious of the fact that by shaping and by creating structures, their own contribution was considerable, if not decisive. Close quote. Quote, while the two accounts have different origins and transmission histories, they have been brought together in a theologically sophisticated fashion to function together. Close quote. In spite of the initial difficulty in establishing the inner relationship between Genesis 1 and 2, both on the oral and literary levels, it is clear at some period in the composition of the book of Genesis that the two accounts were linked in one continuous narrative, close quote. In 2013, the Oxford Bible Commentary observed, quote, the general trend in Old Testament study at present is toward a greater interest in the present form of the text, which is often more coherent than an older generation of critics was willing to accept, even though evidence of reworked older material often remains apparent, close quote. Queering is thus reading anachronistically, as did the giants of 19th and early 20th century German biblical scholarship. Quote, the biblical writers and redactors had certain notions of unity rather different from our own, and that the fullness of statement they aspired to achieve as writers in fact led them at times to violate what a later age and culture would be disposed to think of as canons of unity and logical coherence. Close quote. Genesis 1 through 2 is sophisticated enough that if we think we have spotted a genuine contradiction, we are probably the ones who are confused and not the ancient author. One dissertation cautions against, quote, an emphasis on the contemporary relevance of Genesis 1 through 11 for social equality, gender ideologies, and ecology. It is in this latter emphasis that aggressive social, political, and advocacy criticisms have taken hold, close quote. But it urges, quote, it is crucial in our analysis that we strive to understand the text as it would have been read and understood by the ancient community, close quote. That's certainly how the church uses it in the proclamation, while queering is of the, quote, aggressive socio-political and advocacy, close quote, stream. Discussions of the essential unity and harmony of Genesis 1 through 2 are legion. Hamilton in 1990 stated, quote, the rhetorical features of Genesis 1 through 11 are so distinctly woven into the tapestry as to constitute an unassailable case for the unity of the section, and most likely composition by a single hand. In particular, they find chiasmus in these biblical accounts, the detection of two creation stories based on different names for deity and inconsistencies loses its appeal. The case for homogeneity is much greater than the case for heterogeneity, close quote. Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are thus now seen by many as, quote, two complementary portrayals of creation, close quote. The Jewish Publication Society says that, quote, chapter 2 is not another creation story. As such, it would be singularly incomplete. In fact, it presupposes a knowledge of much of the preceding account of creation. Many of the leading ideas in the earlier account are here reiterated, though the mode of presentation is different, close quote. The Oxford Bible Commentary declares, quote, it is hardly correct to call chapter 2 a second and alternative creation story. Creation of the world is introduced in order to provide a setting for the main story, close quote. The New Cambridge Bible Commentary points out that, quote, contemporary studies in literary theory have taught us that a passage's context is the most important determining feature of interpretation, close quote. For Genesis 2, that context is Genesis 1. Thomas Brodie puts it more colorfully, quote, the two creation texts, Genesis 1 through 2, are indeed very different, but in the context of ancient literature, they are also deeply complementary. Together they represent the two basic literary forms for depicting creation. As such, and in their content, these creation narratives form a unity. But much modern biblical criticism was virtually founded on the separating of these two texts, Genesis 1 through 2, and biblical studies as a whole became contaminated by the example of that foundational barbarism, close quote. Bill Arnold emphasizes, quote, they may have come from different authors originally, but Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 through 3 have been edited together in such an intentional way as to produce a binocular or synoptic view of creation, close quote. Ian Provan agrees, quote, whatever the truth of the process by which Genesis 1 through 2 came into their current form, they certainly do not sit on the page now as two creation stories. They exist now as one entity, albeit looking at creation from slightly differing perspectives, close quote. The recent Anchor Yale Bible translation concurs. Charles argues, quote, the Genesis 2 material thereafter functions not as a duplicate creation account, but as a description of the unfolding of the history of mankind as intended by the creation of the heavens and the earth. The structure of the book has thus altered the semantic level of chapter 2 by assigning it a different role. The Genesis 2 material functions on the level of figurative language, once removed now from its original literal sense. The remarkable success of the redactional linkage is attested to by the history of interpretation, which had little difficulty reading the chapters as a unity until the Enlightenment. Close quote. There is irony in queer theory, whose postmodernism opposes and denies virtually everything the Enlightenment stood for, now insisting on Western canons of strict logical consistency, or demanding that people reflexively accept an approach to Genesis derived from Enlightenment categories of thought. How strange to insist we embrace Brodie's foundational barbarism. Concludes Byrd, quote, the union of a Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 accounts of creation as successive episodes in a comprehensive statement of origins requires the canonical interpreter to observe both the order of the component accounts and the tension between them. It also requires attention to new meanings that move beyond the original terms and intentions of the individual accounts as they are brought within a new and larger context of interpretation. Close quote. In sum, The Latter-day Saint habit of reading the accounts as a complementary whole is well justified and may even represent the majority view today. This does not mean it is true, but the point is that many informed observers of diverse ideologies believe other than Quiring. To make anything more than ideologically driven assertions, it must offer an actual argument and show why the other side is wrong. We are instead given no good reason to accede to Quiring's presentist reading, and no good tools in the references for determining if we are being misled. Is there a source in this text? Unsurprisingly, Quiring wants to queer the idea of sexual essentialism, the idea that biological sex has something fundamental and unchangeable to say about human or divine nature, independent of human culture or convention. It gets an early start by queering even God's name, quote, Elohim, the Israelite deity whose name is queerly morphologically plural, but functions as a singular when it takes a verb, close quote. The text is said to be, quote, immediately ambiguously gendered, close quote, in part by God's creative act in Genesis 1, quote, Elohim speaks in the plural, let us make Adam in our image, according to our likeness, 1:26. The image of Elohim is reflected in the male and female Adam. There is no sense that male and female are pre-existent forms, rather they are contingent, created features that appear at the moment of the creation of the world, close quote. Remarkably, Quiring's section on Genesis 1 through 2 contains only six sources for the author's reliance on textual interpretation. 1. References to later Jewish and Christian sources that saw the primal Adam as androgynous. 2. A feminist reading arguing for intersex creation. 3. Two queer theory sources on the passage. 4. On the translation of Adam. 5. On the translation of rib. 6. On NRSV translation of in the image of God created he them versus he him. I will briefly assess each in the following sections. Later Jewish and Christian sources, source 1. Later Jewish and Christian readings are of limited utility for determining what the original author or authors believed, and are of no value in assessing Latter-day Saint readings. If Quiring just wanted any old text for queer readings, these quite late ones would suffice without involving restoration theology. If the saints appealed to a late rabbinic reading that supported their doctrine on sex, one suspects this would not pass unchallenged. But the underlying goal is to queer, destabilize, and delegitimize the church's doctrine. Feminist reading, source 2, and queer theory, sources 3a and 3b. The feminist reading and two queer theory sources, number 2, number 3a, and number 3b, are also of limited help. They merely tell us that other gender theorists, using the same tactics and techniques utilized in queering, achieved similar readings. But that is precisely the point at issue. Are those readings justifiable from the text if we use the criteria of history and critical study? Are they anything but postmodern ex nihilo conjuration from the void? Source number 2 by Miki Baal contains no novel argument for an androgynous Adam. It simply appeals to and repeats a previous feminist reading by Phyllis Tribble, who is even said by a later analyst to be, quote, not interested in the intentionality of the author, close quote. It is thus not clear why her approach should carry any weight in the case being made in Quiring. Tribble is frequently cited by later commentaries, but almost always to explain why her reading is ill-founded. A detailed treatment by Susan Lancer was published a decade later. Lancer's paper rebutted both Tribble and Baal by name. Neither author comes off well if one cares what the text literally meant to its ancient audience. Source number 3a and source number 3b's queer theory references are examined below in case number 3, which treats Adam's alleged androgyny. Appeals to Hebrew lexicon, sources number 4, number 5, and number 6. The fourth note appeals to a paper by David Clines to argue that, quote, Adam is not a proper name as it has become in common English usage, but a gender neutral term meaning a human being that takes the definite article the Adam, close quote. This is correct so far as it goes and not controversial for our purposes. The same paper, however, contradicts a key part of Quiring's thesis. Quiring insists that the being created in Genesis 2 is not initially male. Clines disagrees completely. Quote, "The human in question from the beginning of the narrative is a man with a woman or wife eventually, but the text, for its own good reasons, does not want to call him a man, Adam, but the human, Ha'adam. The fact that the human is a man and is Adam does not mean that Ha'adam means a man any more than it means Adam, the proper name." Close quote. It thus turns out that this is another source whose inconvenient details Quiring does not disclose. We will again defer full treatment of Adam's alleged androgyny to case number 3. Quiring's sources number 5 and number 6 likewise appeal to text-critical scholarship on the meaning of Hebrew words. Sources number 4 through 6 therefore imply A, that the original text matters more than the translation because it gets us closer to the proper meaning. B, that one can understand the original text to assess its proper meaning and translation. And C, that a translation can convey the meaning of the original with varying degrees of accuracy. All these implicit assumptions are foreign to queer theory and postmodern readings generally. Such an appeal to historical critical information cannot, with consistency, ignore data that runs against its theories. It cannot claim its translation is more accurate and then refuse to consider whether more apt cultural translation or historical critical concepts might undercut its views. This is not to say that one must accept every argument so advanced. Each must be assessed on its merits. But one cannot use an approach on the one hand and then rule it out as irrelevant as soon as it becomes inconvenient on the other, if rigor is valued. It thus remains clear that although at times Quiring wishes to leverage historical critical perspectives, it will warp its method as its agenda requires. There is no intellectual consistency here, no fundamental method. If queer hermeneutics is simply a free pass that allows arbitrary appeals to anything one likes without regard for completeness or self-consistency, then it is valueless. Putting a basketball jersey on a dog won't really let him score slam dunks. Case number 3. An androgynous Adam. All the above leads to a key issue in Quiring's exegesis. Does Genesis make Adam initially an androgynous being, only later differentiated into sexes? Avoiding sexual essentialism for Adam and Eve is arguably even more important for the purposes of Quiring than denying it to God. As the proclamation demonstrates, for humans to be fundamentally male or female is fatal to the entire worldview of queer theory. Quiring tries to find sexual ambiguity in Genesis 1. Quote, "As the text explains, in the image of God, he created him, male, Zakar, and female, Nekabah. He created them." Genesis 1:27. The text is immediately ambiguously gendered. First, the human being is singular, him, and then the human being is plural, them. Second, the human being seems to be male in the singular, but both male and female in the plural. Close quote. Quiring argues further of Genesis 2, quote, "Many interpreters have conflated the two creation stories in an attempt to resolve this problem. In this conflation, following Genesis 1:27, the Adam is both male and female, an intersex creation, who is subsequently divided in the second creation account in Genesis 2:21. Such an interpretation that the Adam is a primal androgyne has a long history in both Jewish and Christian contexts. In this interpretation, the woman was taken from 2:22 and 23, the man because the Adam was both male and female before this moment. Indeed, the interpretive weight must be placed on the claim that the woman was taken from the Adam, that the separation between male and female occurs only at that moment." Close quote. As noted above, Quiring provides a footnote to a later commentary that sees Adam as a primal androgyne. Unfortunately for the queer argument, it would be difficult to find a topic about which textual criticism had been more scathing and more generally united. Complete unity is a rare thing in biblical studies. As summarized in one dissertation on Genesis 2, quote, "that some would argue for man and woman being created from an original bisexual or asexual being around Genesis 2:23 is unfounded and historically naive." Close quote. Next, I consider Genesis 1 and 2 in turn. Genesis 1 androgyny. On this theme in Genesis 1, scholars have been relatively univocal. Quote, "The persistent idea that man as first created was bisexual and the sexes separated afterwards," he here cites Jewish material referenced by Quiring, "is far from the thought of the passage. The plural in Genesis 1:27, he created them, is intentionally contrasted with the singular him and prevents one from assuming the creation of an originally androgynous man. It is an important part of Genesis 1's presentation that the division of the sexes belongs to the immediate creation of humanity. A consequence of this is that there can be no question of an essence of man apart from existence as two sexes. There can only be anything like humanity and human relations where the human species exists in twos. Every theoretical and institutional separation of man and woman, every deliberate detachment of male from female, can endanger the very existence of humanity as determined by creation. Hebrew Adam is a generic term for humankind. It never appears in Hebrew in the feminine or plural. The term encompasses both man and woman, as shown in Genesis 1:27-28 and 5:1-2. The idea is not unknown in ancient literature that man was first created bisexual and only subsequently were the sexes differentiated. Such is clearly not the meaning here. Rather, the verse affirms that God created in his image a male and a female Adam. Both share the image of God. Sexuality is not an accident of nature, nor is it simply a biological phenomenon. Instead, it is a gift of God. That the species Adam is still understood as collective, plural, and bisexual, i.e. sexually dimorphic, is evident in the recapitulation of 1:27 in 5:2, and in the explicit referral of the name, or common noun, to the plural object, male and female, created he them. And he blessed them and named them Adam, 5:2. Genesis 1 is not concerned with sexual roles, the status or relationship of the sexes to one another, or marriage. It describes the biological pair, not a social partnership, male and female, not man and wife. The specification is not dictated by any prehistory that told of a separate creation of man and woman, dependent on the overarching theme of the sustainability, fertility, of the created order. Sex at its most fundamental biological level is not to be despised or deprecated. It is God's gift, and it serves God's purpose in creation by giving to humans the power and the responsibility to participate in the process of continuing creation by which the species is perpetuated. To be human means also to be male or female. The plural of Genesis verse 27 also works against any notion of androgyny. This systematic change in the two most important texts about the creation of Adam as Zakar and Urkabah, male and female, do not support the thesis of an androgynous being in the Genesis 1 account of creation. The Genesis 1 writer needs a differentiation in male and female because it foreshadows the blessing of fertility of verse 28. It is better to translate Ha'adam not as the sexless earthling groundling, but as the man. There is no evidence that Ha'adam suddenly gains gender at the end of the chapter. Rather, his song in Genesis 2:23 presupposes that woman was taken from him when he was already a man. Without reference to male and female, the reader in Genesis 1 would intuit the gender of human beings. However, with gender stipulation, the narrator not only gives sexuality special weight, but also anticipates their ensuing roles in the blessing. The Septuagint follows this shift with ton anthropon, humankind. This makes better sense than presuming a bisexual, androgynous, or even two persons. There is no possibility that the verse is teaching that humans were first androgynous, having both male and female physical characteristics, and afterwards were separated. Close quote. Robert Alter translates Genesis 1:27 as, quote, "God created the human in his image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them." Close quote. His translation note reads, quote, "The term Adam in verse 26, afterward consistently with a definite article, is a generic term for human beings, not a proper noun. It also does not automatically suggest maleness, and so the traditional rendering man is misleading. and that exclusively male Adam would make nonsense of the last clause of verse 27. In the middle clause of verse 27, him, as in the Hebrew, is grammatically but not anatomically masculine. Feminist critics have raised the question as to whether here, and in chapter 2, Adam is to be imagined as sexually undifferentiated until the fashioning of woman, though that proposal leads to certain dizzying paradoxes in following the story. Close quote. One of Queering's own queer theory sources, source number 3a, discusses Genesis 1 and essentially concedes that it cannot be read in Queering's needed way. It then abandons any further discussions of Genesis 1. The source states, quote, "The Genesis 1 account notes at the first appearance of humanity its twofold sexual division, which thus does not support Queering's reading. The binary sexual differentiation of humankind seems, therefore, to be part of God's orderly cosmos from the beginning. Because the linguistic structure of Genesis 1:27 does underscore a binary division of humankind, male and female, he created them, and moves immediately to an emphasis upon reproduction, the text easily lends itself to interpretations that valorize the relation between woman and man and make that relation key to the understanding of human ontology and vocation. The primary point I wish to make, however, is that whatever the original authorial intentions behind Genesis 1:27 might have been, the structure and content of the text as it stands do seem to encourage interpretations that grant a foundational status to binary sexual division as a crucial defining feature of humankind." Close quote. Even the Proclamation on the Family would not argue with much of that. Aside from complaints about theologians who have used the text to conclude negative things about homosexuality and a weak appeal to Greek and Roman evidence that men who had reproductive sex did not always abstain from same-sex activity, the relevance of which for ancient Judaism seems marginal, the source provides little support for the treatment of Genesis 1 by Queering. It concedes far more than Queering does, but is probably wise to do so. Ironically, the queer author complains of Tribble, quote, "It has to be recognized that her argument veers perilously close to the rhetoric of gender complementarity, so often used in support of heterosexist positions." Close quote. Tellingly, then, Queering sources do not even agree with each other about the implications of their ideologically driven readings. Genesis 2 androgyny. What about Genesis 2? The Anchor Yale Bible writes in terms that will resonate with any temple-going saint. Quote, "Ha'adam, the Adam, is the ancestor and symbol of all humans. At the same time, Ha'adam is, as the story unfolds, a single male character. The first mention of Adam in 2:5, in his absence, states his role to work the soil. This is a predominantly male role in the biblical world. The singleness and implicit or incipient maleness of that first man becomes foregrounded when Yahweh sets out to make a partner for him." Some scholars have tried to depatriarchalize the figure of Ha'adam by emphasizing the collective gender-neutral meaning, sometimes arguing that Ha'adam has no sex or gender at all until the creation of woman. But to regard Ha'adam as a sexually polymorphous or unsexed creature is to miss the multivalence of this character, who is both the human and the man. In other words, the depatriarchalized interpretation treats the world as if it were simply a floating signifier, independent of the story's implied meanings or implicature. In the context of its creation, Adam is implicitly a symbolically collective humankind and a single man, with the dual meanings circulating in different proportions throughout the story. Close quote. This analysis serves as an overall summary of the commentary on these verses. We've already seen one of Queering's sources contradicted on this point. Skinner states that, quote, "The notion that the first human being was androgynous and afterwards separated into man and woman finds no countenance in the passage." This assessment is cited with agreement by Gordon Wenham. Lancer is very specific on this point. Quote, "A fairly standard process of inference is at work in the conventional reading of Adam's maleness in Genesis 2. Let me postulate that when a being assumed to be human is introduced into a narrative, that being is also assumed to have a sexual as well as a grammatical gender. The masculine form of Ha'adam and its associated pronouns will, by inference, define Ha'adam as male. I am not suggesting that one cannot read Ha'adam as a sex-neutral figure. I am saying that readers will not ordinarily read Genesis 2 in this way. Gendered humans are the unmarked case. It is not Adam's maleness that would have to be marked, but the absence of maleness. In this instance, two reinforcing systems of inference are at work. The inference brought a priori to the reading of Genesis 2:7, that a living creature named with masculine pronouns will be male, and the inference drawn a posteriori from the reading, that since the creature being created as a helper is a woman, then the creature for and from whom she has been created is already a man. As far as I can determine, this process of inference operates as fully in biblical Hebrew as, say, in modern French, which is also a language of dual gender. Ironically, Ball's own description of this moment unwittingly reproduces precisely the androcentrism of Genesis 2 itself. God brings the woman to Ha'adam, she says, who by the recognition of the other assumes his own sexual identity. This focus on the male subject is reinforced by the narrator's use in the very next two verses, 2:24 and 2:25, and on three occasions thereafter, of the possessive structure Ha'adam ve'esto, the human and his woman, close quote. Some further examples. Quote, we should not conclude either from Genesis 2 or from 1:27 that the first human being was androgynous. To suggest that the primal being was an androgyne is to read into the text what is not there. An androgyny theory requires some gymnastics. God does not propose to divide an earth creature into two beings who are counterparts for each other. Rather, God decides to make a counterpart for the Adam, for the already existing human being. He is not an earth creature before the separation and a male human being afterwards. When he meets Eve, he has not changed physically. Sexuality has not been newly created. The first creature in the story is a male man from the beginning. That the story of Genesis 2 is told from the point of view of the man and is thus clearly androcentric in construction does not alter this basic tone of the account as a tone of mutuality and equality. If we are reading Genesis 2 along with Genesis 1, we have already been told in Genesis 1:27 that the Adam is both male and female. Close quote. Bird provides a fitting conclusion. Quote, presented as an individual, Adam, with the article in contrast to Genesis 1's collective Adam, without the article, and envisioned as a male, specifically a peasant farmer, the name by which he is designated betrays his true identity and the problem of his singularity. For although he bears the appellation of the species, he does not fully represent it. The personification is defective in its limitation to the male alone. The remainder of the chapter describes in dramatic action the overcoming of that defect and the resolution of the tension latent in the initial presentation. Close quote. It would seem the church's doctrinal view is on much firmer ground than Quiring will allow. It is definitely on firmer ground than is Quiring itself. Quiring's queer theory source number 3a, says of Genesis 2, quote, Genesis 2 can also be seen as serving the interests of hegemonic heterosexuality. The story as a whole seems not only to insist upon binary sexual difference, but also to underscore the inevitability of sexual reproduction. Yet, there are certain features of the text that make its support for the heterosexual contract somewhat problematic. It is interesting to note, for example, that the text finds it necessary to specify in 3:16b that the woman's desire or longing will be directed toward her man, and that this specification of heterosexual desire occurs in a list of those features of human existence that result from the pair's transgressions. What are we to make of this surprising and often ignored statement? A reader might very well conclude from it that heterosexual desire on the part of the woman is itself a consequence of, or even a punishment for, the woman's misdeeds rather than an original component of her created nature. And it is striking that the text, as worded, seems to display a certain amount of insecurity about the woman's desire for the man, having to insist upon that desire as something that God ordains, while also allowing the reader to reach the conclusion that such desire is a consequence of the woman's rebellion, a consequence that might not have been any more certain than other consequences, as, for example, the woman's increased pain in childbirth, or the man's having to toil and labor as he worked a recalcitrant earth, or the snake's having to crawl upon its belly. Close quote. With allies like these, queering needs no opponents. The insecurity about heterosexual desire is only visible to those seeking to undercut the pre-fall sexual complementarity that is everywhere implied and stated. God's very good creation can hardly proceed to be fruitful and multiply for animals and humans if the two sexes are intended to have no mutual desire or instinctive drive toward reproduction. Queering's source also appeals to Tribble and Ball for an androgynous reading, but we have already seen how weak and ill-supported they are. There is nothing novel in its treatment of the same issues. The author even goes on to acknowledge the saliency of the critiques of Tribble and Ball's reading and concludes by rather lamely claiming the Genesis 2 account is, quote, riven with tensions and contradictions, close quote. This is Queering's approach. But as we've seen, such a reading is anachronistic and flat. The supposed problems and contradictions come mainly from trying vainly to make the text say something it resolutely doesn't want to say, and reading it in a presentist style foreign to its genre. The queer theory source then moves on, with some evident relief, to a completely different tactic. Quote, "It may be productive to read this text in dialogue with the work of Howard Eilberg Schwartz. For in a provocative study indebted to Freud, Eilberg Schwartz argues that the discourse of the Hebrew Bible is overdetermined at numerous points by an attempt to deny the implications of an unconscious homoerotic relation between Israel's male deity and that deity's male worshiper. Is it possible, then, that the representation of Yahweh's search for an appropriate partner for Adam is the reflex of a felt need on the part of the text's writer to preclude the possibility of this sort of homoerotic relationship?" Close quote. The answer, in a word, is no. The study is doubtless provocative, but that hardly means reasonable or plausible. Provocative even seems calculated to sound like praise without having to commit to an opinion on the actual merits of an argument. Quote, "It may be productive to read," close quote. Well, is it or isn't it? And if it is, why don't you tell us why? Regardless, Eilberg Schwartz and concerns about Butlerian performativity occupy the remainder of the queer theory essay. This is much more in Queering's vein, and it is no more convincing here. Eilberg Schwartz's oeuvre is titled God's Phallus and Other Problems for Men and Monotheism. That, and its debt to Freud, perhaps tell us all we need to know, at least in a family publication. It demonstrates at least the level of erudition that Queering offers. Mark S. Smith's treatment of Israelite monotheism contains a blunt castigation of this stunted approach. Quote, "It is unnecessary, and it is not supported by any biblical text, to argue that monotheistic Yahweh involved either androgyny or homoeroticism. Such views appear eisegetical and seem based in a wooden reading." Close quote. Queering uses this source, but didn't listen. The debt to Freud also demonstrates one of the many enormous self-contradictions in queer theory, and the other postmodernisms. They are fiercely proud of their radical skepticism about almost everything, while often enthusiastically swallowing wholesale the pseudo-scientific bilge of Freud and fellow traveler Ludwig Feuerbach. Feuerbach's central claim was that ideas about God were nothing but humans projecting themselves onto the divine. Karl Marx was deeply enamored of this supposed solution to the issue of religion, though he extended and critiqued Feuerbach's approach. Anyone who thinks Feuerbach's or Freud's just-so stories explain anything is hard to take seriously. Their approaches are the poster children for unfalsifiability. After all we've seen, can it really be fairly said with Queering that, quote, "As many interpreters have noted, even the version in Genesis is far more compatible with gender fluidity than gender essentialism," close quote. No, and that dog can't really slam dunk either. No unanimity. We must acknowledge that a few of the sources considered above contain some marginal support for Queering's reading. Nort writes that, quote, "Describing the human being as androgynous does not fit into the scope of the narrative," close quote, in Genesis 2. He also argues that the, quote, "Adam in Genesis 2, 7-17, is neither man nor woman," close quote, which helps Queering's case. But he also says that in Genesis 1, there is no androgyny.
Provan likewise sees Genesis 2 as featuring an initial, quote, proto-human, close quote, or earthling, but also emphasizes that the reader will already have encountered Genesis 1, in which there is no androgyny. Thus, neither of these authors support Queering's reading of Genesis 1, though agreeing somewhat with its take on Genesis 2. In any case, we have just seen the many authorities who reject androgyny in the primordial Adam in Genesis 2. Provan also avoids calling the Adam in Genesis 2 a male, since he argues, like Queering, that we require gender differentiation before we can speak meaningfully of male and female. He also wants to avoid the idea that males preceded females. This idea has certainly been abused throughout the history of interpretation to give men power over women. This avoidance is not without a double edge, however, since it also deprives feminist readers of the absolute observation that God creates in an ascending hierarchy, with woman as the crowning finale. If the initial Adam is not male, then males and females come into existence at the same moment of the Adam's fission. Demanding both sexes be created before either can be described is a weak argument in the context of Latter-day Saint theology, which has embodied heavenly parents. Adam and Eve are, thereby, hardly the first male and female. Rather, sex differentiation long predates the Genesis creation, and Adam has just seen all the animals paraded in front of him to be named. Are we to presume that they are not already sexed? The text will not support it. Besides, how dim must we make the first human to think that he, it, sees each paired species and yet could not conceive of him itself as male without ever having seen a human female? Part of the pathos of the scene and the reason for the man's joyful burst of poetry upon meeting the woman comes precisely because of what Adam knows was missing. The biblical account would be the poorer without this dimension. Holotypes. Queering is keen to find any shred of gender ambiguity and triumphantly brandishes the fact that in the JST revision of Genesis, Moses 2:27, God and Jesus' sexed bodies are said to be the image after which male and female bodies are created. Note that either scenario can be recruited to the queer reading. In Genesis, God is not given a sex and is claimed to support a queer reading. Quote, "The image of Elohim is reflected in the male and female Adam. There is no sense that male and female are pre-existent forms. Rather, they are contingent, created features that appear at the moment of the creation of the world." Close quote. But when Joseph Smith makes God's sex utterly unambiguous in Moses, then this is flipped around and queered as well. And in the bargain, Queering can claim that there are thereby new contradictions and gaps between these passages, which supposedly just goes to prove their interpretive instability. Using a get-out-of-jail-free card like this is nice work if you can get it, but it is transparently self-serving. The answer is determined up front. It is also deeply uninformed to think that any fuzziness or ambiguity or queerness is introduced by creating a female body that uses a male as a template, the fathers and the sons in this case. The confusion is not surprising, since queer theorists seem to know little about biology and accept even less. The idea, however, is simple for those without an ideological need to deny sexual essentialism. Each species described by science has a holotype. As the American Museum of Natural History puts it, this, quote, "is the single specimen that a researcher designates as the name-bearing representative of a new species," close quote. So, if a new species of mammal were discovered, say a canine gifted at hoops, species Aris buddis, a single individual, female or male, would be designated the species holotype by its discoverer. All other classification, study, and identification of other members of the species must refer to that single individual. For those species for whom males and females are greatly dissimilar, quote, "researchers sometimes designate an allotype, a specimen of the opposite sex of the holotype," quote, quote. This is done much more informally and is not even officially regulated or tracked. We can well imagine a critical theorist in high dudgeon if females could not be encompassed in a male holotype definition. Just as modern science can define a species by a single exemplar of either sex, so does God act as the holotype for humanity in Moses. Sexes are a fundamental part of species. It is almost incoherent to think of species without this core aspect. There must be a Mrs. Airbud, even if we've never met her. No biologist is so ill-informed or so incompetent as to be unable to recognize the female of a species based on a male holotype specimen, unless there are massive anatomical differences, which there assuredly are not in humans. One would not, as both Queering and a few commentators seem to think, even need to have seen a female example of the species to, 1, identify the holotype as a novelty, 2, recognize that the holotype was male, 3, predict that a female must also exist, and 4, have a decent idea of what she would be like. The biologist, like Adam, has seen many animals, and their sexed complementarity is a given. I dare say most non-professionals would not struggle either, save in a few unusual cases. No ancient audience, with their intimate knowledge of domestic and prey animals, would have any trouble either. If a detail-oriented field like present-day biology can get by like this, the pre-modern scripture surely can. Genre again. In one of the 20th century's magisterial commentaries, Gerhard von Rad underlined how vulnerable Genesis 2 was to misappropriation and misreading by those ignorant of its conventions. Quote, "The text of Genesis 2 presents a narrative. It is not doctrine, at least not in the direct sense. But rather, it tells a story, a part of a traveled road that cannot be traversed again. One must therefore bear in mind that here a factual report is meant to be given about facts which everyone knows and whose reality no one can question. They concern the field upon which the story of man with God is played, and the means of presentation, which serve to make the process more tangible, are correspondingly different from those applied by the historian. We read a narrative that proceeds amidst the simplest and clearest imagery, but that, of course, does not mean it does not intend throughout to report actuality. The story certainly also contains a didactic element, but much less directly than does Genesis 1. It is concealed in the facts that are placed before the reader. And here is the source of so many false expositions. The narrative demands that we follow the way it goes precisely. There is perhaps no other biblical text whose witness proceeds from a road as narrow as a razor's edge. One misses the road completely if one does not entrust oneself to it completely." Close quote. But it is this trust that queer theory simply will not permit itself. It clings to postmodernism's hermeneutic of suspicion. To obsess as it does about precisely where in a linear temporal sequence of an origin story the sexing of humanity occurs, will virtually guarantee that it will be misled, because that is simply not how this type of story works. Queer theory's vision of a proper reading wants answers that the Genesis author would never have given to questions he would never have asked. Klaus Westermann was the other 20th century titan of Genesis commentary, and he too emphasized chapters 2 through 3. Quote, "The passage has shown that there are certain extremes which are to be avoided. Among these are approaches which are purely literary historical, or belong merely to the history of religions, as well as those which begin from an already formulated ideology and from fixed dogmatic principles." Close quote. What could better describe queer theory than the last? He continues, quote, "The text of Genesis 2 through 3 is complex and contains many different elements. Account must be taken of this complexity. All attempts to explain Genesis 2 through 3, which look for the key to the explanation in one motif or in a single detail of that text, are of their very nature questionable. The history of exegesis has shown that the starting point must be the text as a whole and its structure, and that only exegesis based thereon leads anywhere." Close quote. Byrd is likewise adamant about the genre and its conventions. Quote, "Of fundamental importance for an understanding of the author's statement about sexuality is the literary form and structure of the narrative. In the Genesis 2 account, story and the storyteller's art replace the liturgical cadences and technical terminology of priestly declaration in Genesis 1. Circular movement marks the narrative structure in contrast to the linear progression of Genesis 1, and dramatic action is employed to describe states and relationships. Time has no meaning here, and sequence of action no ontological significance. The first and final acts of creation together describe a single action. The creation of humankind is not complete until the woman stands beside the man, manifesting that essential aspect of humanity hidden or latent in the first exemplar. Only when the pair appear together on the stage do the divine-human interaction and the consequential action of the story begin. Close quote. Summing up. Ironically, even if we grant Quiring's reading of an androgynous or unsexed Adam for the sake of argument, we can now see that the scripture undermines the argument that sex isn't foundational to God's creative work. Critical commentary is unanimous that the sexual nature of humans and the vital complementarity inherent in heterosexual pairing is the whole point. Quote, the intention is clear. The process of creation itself explains how man and woman belong together. Close quote. Queer theory presents a ludicrous spectacle as it ties itself in knots to eke out even a brief sliver of primordial time in which there was a potential transient non-sexed humanity. Meanwhile, the Bible goes to extraordinary lengths to celebrate, affirm, and insist upon the necessity and divine origin of sexed humanity and heterosexual marriage. Queer theory is reduced to plucking the grit from the gears of the story and then relying on false bravado to claim that such scraps were the real reason for the machine's construction. Its decision to ignore genre conventions makes nonsense of the text, and it can only find its own distorted reflection in it. In short, to read Genesis 2 as Quiring does is to fail exegetically on almost every level. Quiring strolls into a game of chess and insists on playing Candyland, a game where the outcome is predetermined from the start and the players consume imaginary empty calories. Part 4. The Double Standards. We could pursue the foregoing type of analysis indefinitely, even if the reader's patience is not already exhausted, mine is. If you choose to read Quiring, prepare for lots more of the same. If you've seen one Air Bud, you've essentially seen the sequels. The most maddening thing about postmodern theories is how thoroughly saturated they are with double standards. They assure us confidently that no one can be competent about much. They are skeptical of almost everything except themselves and their tribe. They tell us all discourse is about unrecognized power plays and proceed as if they are revealing hidden truths with no ulterior motives. Quote, the cliché that one often ends up where one started points out how assumptions about gender might shape how one reads these texts, close quote. Very likely true, and certainly a cliché. But doesn't that apply at least as much to Quiring? Postmodern theorists offer us logical arguments containing logical flaws to convince us that logic is impotent. They insist that communication acts can only reflect the recipient's culture, bias, and power quest, not the mind or message of the author, and then brandish textual proofs when someone's reading disagrees with theirs. The author of Quiring provided a beautiful example recently. An online post offered an early Christian work as proof that God has a body. Our queer theorist took issue. Quote, posts like this are historical, philological, and theological malpractice. It's fine to look for precedents of LDS theology in ancient Christianity, but such efforts need to not distort it for cheap apologetics. Close quote. What can one say but amen? I'm even tempted to say, quote, it's fine to look for precedents of queer theory in LDS theology, but such efforts need to not distort it for cheap queer apologetics, close quote. Otherwise, what you get is, quote, historical, philological, and theological malpractice, close quote, as demonstrated. And this sounds a lot like someone who believes that texts have an inherent meaning to them, and that we need to consider historical and philological factors before we opine about what they mean. It sounds like he thinks one could misrepresent texts and make them say things that they don't say, and that others can tell when they're misrepresenting them. He has further posts arguing that pro-gun advocates are guilty of, quote, an incredibly tortured misreading of the Second Amendment, close quote, and that Donald Trump has offered, quote, as clear of a document to justify authoritarianism as you can possibly imagine, close quote. Couldn't we reply that he just hasn't queered Trump's blueprint adequately to appreciate that it is really a map for egalitarianism? I suspect that we would meet spirited resistance. Why should his reading of the Second Amendment be accepted in preference to an allegedly tortured pro-gun interpretation? Queer theory cannot provide a cogent answer. In fact, if consistent, it should welcome the queer tortured reading above the supposedly clear and commonplace. Quite simply, no one can live their life as if queer theory or the other critical theories are actually true. I suspect everyone, like Queering's author, apparently believes deep down that texts do have an intended meaning, and that we can usually discern what that is to a reasonable degree, and that it is wrong to torture the text or distort it for ideological purposes, at least if it is for an ideology we dislike. If you doubt it, refuse to pay the theorists their salaries and watch how quickly they become believers in a definitive meaning of written contracts. There will be no kibitzing about a hidden subtext to be queered to support contract breaking instead of contract keeping, even if thieves are oppressed and underrepresented minorities. After all, queer theorists write texts arguing for their views, a strange choice if no one could understand their meaning. Everyone, including Queering's author, would be upset if their texts were misrepresented. He'd be outraged if I queered his book and claimed that it praised Adolf Hitler or Donald Trump. We all know that this is the case, and yet we're expected to humor the fiction that they really believe the ideology that pervades their books. Power and influence. Not only is queer theory and its attendant worldview hostile to the core of Latter-day Saint practice and theology, but queering goes out of its way to describe its prominence and legitimacy. Quote, today, queer studies of religion may be transgressive in some quarters, but at the same time enjoy a claim to be academic mainstream. Most major seminaries and divinity schools employ scholars who specialize in these methods or offer classes on them. For instance, university presses publish this work, and there are numerous subgroups of the Society of Biblical Literature and the American Academy of Religion that deal with these topics. These are hardly fringe movements anymore, at least within the elite and rarefied halls of the academic study of religion. Close quote. By this description, key elite areas of our culture have embraced queer theory and its metaphysical commitments. It is, as we have seen, an ideology that is all-consuming and does not brook rivals. It is philosophically founded on the premise that all discourse is a zero-sum exercise of power over societal rivals. A maligned minority. The Church of Jesus Christ has been a minority faith since its founding. Their lot was persecution and repeated attempts to force conformity with the religious, political, economic, and social views of the dominant culture. In the 19th century, anti-Mormons used cultural power to misdefine what members were and how they should be viewed. They did this by systematically misrepresenting church doctrine and texts, attempting to shame them, and encouraging those on the cultural fringes of the church to act as spokespeople or paragons of how a sensible Mormon should behave. While the church and its members became more tolerated as the 20th century progressed, American society has retained a significant core of bigotry and bias against them. Conservative Protestants go to great lengths, for example, to deny saints the self-understanding as Christians. Matters have improved from the days in which members of the church were jailed and disenfranchised because of their beliefs, to say nothing of violence committed against them. But being a member of the church remains a substantial liability in the American political arena, for example. Warned one researcher, quote, aversion to Mormons is still an important force in American public opinion, and if anything, is increasing, close quote. Fully 18% of the electorate would not vote for a Mormon as president as of 2015. Gay presidential candidates were ruled out by 24% of voters in the same survey. Queer theory is keen to paint itself as defending the weak and marginalized LGBTQ+, but church members cannot be said on these grounds to have much advantage. In terms of those who have negative perceptions of them, quote, Mormons have fallen below evangelical Christians, Muslims, and atheists, close quote. David Smith noted in 2014 that although there is hostility against Mormons from both the secular left and the religious right, quote, it is the former that has increased heavily over the past 5 years, quote, quote. Queer theory is clearly part of this ideological coalition on the secular left. Quote, if anti-Mormonism is not more widespread than other prejudices, close quote, warned Smith, quote, it is certainly more socially acceptable, close quote. As of 2023, quote, one quarter of Americans hold an unfavorable view of Latter-day Saints, close quote, which is about the same percentage as those who believe same-sex relationships are morally wrong. Media. We can be glad that the caricature and cruelty previously directed toward homosexuals in media and entertainment is much reduced from what it once was. Many modern media properties are careful to include gay characters and to paint them in a favorable light. Some would argue that this is even done when it ill serves the story. Similar consideration does not apply, however, to members of the church. Any religious believer tends to be stereotyped or maligned in modern Hollywood, but the saints continue to be singled out for even worse treatment. A Broadway musical that mocks church members and their beliefs continues to be an enormous hit. In 2025, a Netflix miniseries portrays the saints as exceedingly violent, blames Brigham Young for the massacre at Mountain Meadows, resurrects the murderous Danite trope, frames church members as domestic terrorists, blames them for attempting to exterminate Native Americans, says that the saints saw violence as a way of spreading their faith, and paints women as powerless victims of a brutal patriarchy. A 2024 horror movie starring Hugh Grant murdering sister missionaries made over $58 million, with an aggregator reporting 91% approval from critics. One sister missionary who suffered a real-life stabbing attack in her apartment wrote, quote, the more realistic portrayal of these missionaries made the doctrinal and social inaccuracies more nuanced and harder to identify for those unfamiliar with the church. With no consequence, Hollywood creates a false narrative and presents $52 million worth of moviegoers with a distorted perception while hiding behind artistic license as an explanation, close quote. As we will see below, Petrie is a fan of the movie. As Terrell Gibbons concluded of the 21st century media environment, quote, beneath the trendy veil of appreciative diversity and difference lurk the familiar 19th century slurs. Close quote. Who has the power? As queer theorists are quick to point out when discussing sexual minorities, living as a minority of any sort in a host society has unique challenges. One psychologist, highly educated and a voluntary immigrant to the United States from his native Philippines, asked, quote, why do I think that anything made in the United States is better than anything made in my motherland, the Philippines? Why do I believe that speaking English without a Filipino accent is a marker of intelligence and higher social status? Why do I feel ashamed and embarrassed to admit that I am proficient in Tagalog and that I am Filipino? And why do I stay away from the sun and use skin whitening products to make my skin lighter? Close quote. His answer was internalized oppression, that is, quote, a devaluation or inferiorization of oneself and one's group, close quote. The problem does not arise in a vacuum. Quote, oppression occurs when one group has more access to power and privilege than another group, and when that power and privilege is used to maintain the status quo, i.e. domination of one group over another. Close quote. Who has the power in the case of queer theory and the Latter-day Saints? Queering begins with its author detailing how mainstream and broadly disseminated queer studies has become in academia. It certainly sounds like it has power and cachet. His book, after all, has been published by an academic press. His previous book, which misrepresented the historical record egregiously, nevertheless received the Best Book Award from the Mormon History Association. The author has also been the editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, which gave him yet more power and influence in Mormon studies. He is framed as an expert by the press. In sum, he can subtly or overtly affect how the academy and the world sees the church and its members. Now, a thought experiment. How welcome would someone with my views about sex and gender be in his gender studies class, his academic religion class, or the university department that he chairs? What are the chances that I could ever be hired in that environment? And what are the chances that I could keep a job if I did get one without constantly self-censoring? After all, the author tells us that my faith, the most important thing in my world, the core of my identity, quote, is deeply imbued within its contextual values of patriarchy, racism, and heterosexism, close quote. What's more, this isn't a problem only in the distant past, but, quote, Mormonism has an ongoing active participation in such a culture, close quote. Those don't sound like good things. Who would even want to associate with such a culture? Don't worry, though. Despite all the racism, patriarchy, and so forth, quote, the tradition is unable to be reduced to and caricatured by this description, close quote. Well, thank goodness we won't be stooping to reductive caricature. All the tradition needs is a little queering. The theology can then be salvaged from itself. Who has more influence on how elite opinion sees the church? The average member in the pew or Petrie? The question answers itself. This would seem, at least at first glance, to be a case where oppression is possible, maybe even probable, by the lights of critical theory. Queer theory teaches us that all discourse is fundamentally about power, and that includes books written by a gender studies professor about a religious group for the academy. I don't think all discourse is about power, but I'm willing to believe some do think this and do act accordingly. Intellectual colonialism. The point is simple. Queering is part of an attempt by a dominant elite and evangelizing worldview to colonize the thought and practice of an unpopular minority group. If this kind of thing were happening to a more fashionable minority instead of the saints, critical and queer theorists would regard it as morally reprehensible. The double standard is striking. Oppression, it seems, quote, is the act of imposing on others a label, such as racist or sexist, role, experience, that is unwanted, needlessly painful, and detracts from physical and psychological well-being, such as degrading job roles, ridicule, and negative media images and messages that foster and maintain distorted beliefs, close quote. One example is anti-Mormonism, quote, in the case of anti-Mormonism, non-Mormons hold power and privilege over Mormons, i.e. non-Mormons are more likely to be in positions of power. And that position is used to maintain power and privilege. This justification is often based on the supposed superiority of one group over another. Again, in the case of anti-Mormonism, non-Mormons deny access to resources based on the argument that Mormons are abnormal, deviant, pathological, and are abominations, racist, heterosexist, patriarchal, their leaders wanting homosexuals killed, etc. Inferiorizing labels and perceptions imposed onto them by the dominant group, close quote. Now, I must immediately fess up. The authors didn't quite say this. In fact, instead of Mormon and non-Mormon, they used the terms non-heterosexual and heterosexual, respectively. Mea culpa. The argument is otherwise unchanged. I trust that if Petrie had read the paragraph as it originally stood, he would be nodding enthusiastically. No one should be treated that way. So why doesn't he bother to apply the lesson to a different minority group? The paradigm of oppression can be applied to any group with a common identity and a historical narrative bound up in oppression. One need not have a recent, quote, forceful entry by a foreign group, close quote, to see these dynamics at work. All that is needed is a society, quote, characterized by social inequalities, cultural or worldview imposition of the dominant group, like queering your theology and misrepresenting your leaders in history, devaluation of oppressed groups' cultures or worldviews, and stereotypical recreation of oppressed groups' identities by the dominant group, close quote. Franz Fanon on colonialism. Franz Fanon was born on the island of Martinique, one of the French Caribbean colonial possessions. He served in the Free French Forces in World War II and later practiced psychiatry in Algeria during the revolts against French colonialism that convulsed that country during the 1950s. Now, I hardly endorse all of Fanon's views or choices. I don't admire his communist sympathies, though I think I understand their appeal to him, or aspects of his personal life. He was, however, a keen observer and extraordinarily articulate. His psychiatric case studies from victims on both sides of the Afghan wars are harrowing reading, and they betray a deep sensitivity and humanity. His analysis of colonialism is still a landmark. He describes various phases of the colonial experience, and it is worthwhile to see what they might teach us here. Phase 1. Forced entry of a foreign group into a territory to exploit its natural resources. In intellectual terms, this is precisely what queering is attempting. It says as much. The intent is to take sources that, quote, are largely the conventional, even canonical ones, reinterpreting them from a queer perspective and challenging heteronormative representations within the faith, close quote. It will, quote, look at theological questions and texts not to reify their authority, but to destabilize the interpretive traditions that have been built up around them, close quote. Amusingly, queering even says that Osler's work, quote, holds some resources, close quote, it can use. These resources from, quote, the LDS tradition, close quote, are then misappropriated and distorted for its ends. At best, then, Latter-day Saint thought is a raw material of which the natives are not making proper use. It is necessary that their academic betters intervene. All that bauxite is just sitting there. Petrie's manipulative use of statements by church leaders is emblematic of this phase. When he disagrees with leaders, he is willing to misrepresent them and works mightily to problematize or queer their discourse, regardless of the facts. Yet he also pushes a list of quotes from them that support the use of other Bible translations. If he regards apostolic teaching as authoritative, why does he strain out the gnat of the matter, like which Bible version to read, while swallowing the camel of legitimizing gay sex? It looks rather cynical. He obviously doesn't regard 2 centuries of unanimous apostolic teaching on chastity as inspired or binding. Then, despite his manifest disdain for and distrust for these leaders, he is willing to exploit his co-religionist respect for them to push what he wants. A trusting theological native might assume that anyone quoting leaders as authoritative has friendly intentions. But at base, the saint's convictions and norms are made just another fulcrum for alien priorities. Fanon describes the typical reactions. Quote, the native's reactions are not unanimous. While the mass of the people maintain intact traditions, which are completely different from those of the colonial situation, the intellectual throws himself in frenzied fashion into the frantic acquisition of the culture of the occupying power and takes every opportunity of unfavorably criticizing his own national culture. Close quote. What then happens? The native intellectual has thrown himself greedily upon Western culture. Like adopted children who only stop investigating the new family framework at the moment when a minimum nucleus of security crystallizes in their psyche, the native intellectual will try to make European culture his own. He will not be content to get to know Rabelais and Diderot, Shakespeare and Edgar Allan Poe. He will bind them to his intelligence as closely as possible. Close quote. Trade Western culture for secular queer theory, Shakespeare for Judith Butler, and Diderot for Derrida, and we have a close match, though the queer theorist gets shortchanged compared to the Algerian. Phase 2. Recreate the indigenous culture as defined by the colonizer. Quote, this isn't, we're told, a matter of making queer theory compatible or reconciled with Latter-day Saint thought. Rather, it is a method or approach that may be taken to any system, including Latter-day Saint thought, close quote. So the goal is not to create a harmony, nor is it even to elevate minority voices within the tradition. It allegedly needn't even be the Latter-day Saint tradition that gets this treatment. Any would do. Notwithstanding, the leaders and the canon will be seized to queer, quote, the gendered assumptions of each of the central characters of the Godhead from within the tradition, close quote. This will redefine the tradition in queer theory's own image and starts with the most sacred beings and relationships in Restoration theology. Fanon's model says that, quote, the colonizer imposes its culture, disintegrates the indigenous culture, that sounds a lot like deconstruction, actually, and recreates the indigenous culture as defined by the colonizer, close quote. As Quirin states, quote, this is not a reclamation, but a resignification, close quote. Quite so. It is not taking back something that once belonged to queer theory. It is seizing and fundamentally altering the resources to mean something entirely different in order to undermine the original. Quirin will instead create a, quote, Mormon cosmos, not as an idealization of either sex or kinship, but rather as a desire, a lust, a fantasy expression of human relations, close quote. The point is to, quote, traverse the Mormon cosmos in ways that often turn it on its head or inside out, close quote. Indeed, a Disneyfied native village, a lovely backdrop for the tourists, quote, kinship must not be collapsed into the family, the domestic, or the heterosexual, close quote, which is to say the entire meaning it is given in Saint's actual theology, quote, but must be disruptive of these concepts, close quote. Quote, the notion of a humanoid god itself is ontologically and philosophically unsustainable without veering into science fiction, yet that does not mean it is not useful to think with, close quote, we are told. The benighted savages have charming myths, which might provide an aesthetic for my next operetta, but no thinking man can take them seriously. There's not even a pause to acknowledge that the saints might have had some ontological or philosophical thoughts about the matter beyond the realm of Buck Rogers. A Victorian citizen scientist could not be more condescending than this, quote, the approach offered here participates in some respects in what has broadly been called the ontologic turn in the social sciences and religious studies, which emphasizes taking seriously the worlds constructed by cultural subjects as theoretical elaborations, close quote. But this isn't taking it seriously. Quirin expressly intends to invert the meaning and undermine these ideas. We really treasure your culture. How about if we make it a logo on a Coca-Cola cup? It is the syrupy insincerity that cloys the most. I prefer my intellectual imperialism as open flourishments on the gunboats. Quote, for many, this cosmos is real and really present. The analysis in the current volume does not take away from this, but it does allow a Mormon cosmos to be accessed and found meaningful by those who may view its metaphysical claims as otherwise nonsensical or irrelevant, close quote. For some, the, quote, Latter-day Saint sloganeering that family is forever does not seem like a description of heavenly bliss, close quote. The saints' deepest doctrines, the pinnacles of their worship, and the sum of their theology is reduced by Quirin to sloganeering, to accommodate those who find it either nonsensical or irrelevant. We are patted on the head and assured that this portrayal takes nothing away from us, but I am not so sure. Phase 3A. The colonized are portrayed as wild, savage, and uncivilized. Colonialism, says one introductory work, quote, regularly includes the shaming of native people and alienated groups for the putative inferiority of their culture, close quote. The barbarians need to be tamed, brought to the light. Quote, the colonizer has to nobly monitor, tame, and civilize. It essentially conveys that tyranny and domination, and hence oppression, are necessary, close quote. This attitude litters Quirin. Quote, the mainstream church held its hegemony over the bulk of its membership, close quote. Quote, my primary purpose is not an analysis of early Mormon plural marriage practices to get at the truth of the matter, and certainly not to redeem them, close quote. That's a fairly candid statement. They won't be dispassionately analyzed. Ascertaining the truth, which gets postmodern scare quotes, isn't the goal, nor can they hope for the redemption that sympathetic understanding or study might provide. But they will be queered. Even those who might be thought ideological fellow travelers don't escape the need for correction. Beware, quote, the lack of intersectional analysis in earlier Mormon feminist depictions of Heavenly Mother, close quote. Fortunately, they have a white male academic to uplift them with the latest swanky critical theory. A Latter-day Saint conservative feminist, Valerie M. Hudson Kastler, is chastised because she supposedly, quote, takes for granted men's indispensability, while women's indispensability must be rooted in a function of their bodies, close quote. That sounds pretty primitive and backward. It also sounds like a summary that Hudson would not agree accurately reflects her views. But one suspects Petrie is still smarting from the philosophical and theological drubbing she gave him during his last foray into these woods. All discourse is about power. Unlike Petrie, those who have sought to oppose the family proclamation have only thought to emphasize, quote, its non-canonical status or laid out ideological objections to its teachings, close quote. So even those who were supposedly on the right ideological track remain too blinkered to see where the real solution lies. Postmodernism reminds us that whatever Quirin offers must be just as much an ideological objection, but that goes safely unanalyzed. Quote, The teaching of spirit birth holds some popular support, close quote. We can practically hear the condescending chuckle as a titter runs round the seminar room. But, quote, the doctrine itself is historically, logically, and ethically dubious, close quote. Those poor Mormons, they don't even know their history, they don't do logic, and the popular masses can't think through the ethical implications either. I do not intend here to defend or debunk the teaching itself, merely to highlight the author's implicit attitude and approach. You can almost hear Rudyard Kipling, half devil and half child. Phase 3B, improving the world. No culture is perfect. They all have their injustices and imperfections. In Algeria, Fanon observed how the French colonizers tried to use the plight of Algerian women, who tended to be veiled and not seen on their own in public, as both an excuse for their domination and as a tool to extend it. Quote, around the family life of the Algerian, the occupier piled a whole mass of judgments, appraisals, reasons, accumulated anecdotes, and edifying examples, thus attempting to confine the Algerian within a circle of guilt. Colonial society blazes up vehemently against this inferior status of the Algerian woman. Its members worry and show concern for those unfortunate women doomed to produce brats, kept behind walls, banned. The occupier, smarting from his failures, presents in a simplified and pejorative way the system of values by means of which the colonized person resists his innumerable offensives. What is in fact the assertion of a distinct identity, concerned with keeping intact a few shreds of national existence, is attributed to religious, magical, fanatical behavior. Close quote. Queering likewise complains about the traditional preoccupations of some thinkers within the church. Quote, it has long been an annoyance of mine that so much intellectual and financial capital was invested in LDS evangelical dialogues in earlier decades, where LDS tried to prove they were Christians, close quote. A secularist might well find this difficult to understand, as Petrie does too, but many of these efforts were not and are not motivated by a desire to prove something. I know many who participated in those discussions, and they typically doubted that they would convince those who made such claims, but a reply was given to help others who might be listening. The 19th century gave us considerable experience with what happens when other religions define us to government and the popular mind. In any case, someone who spends years trying to prove that queer theory has anything worthwhile to say about restoration of scripture has no standing to cast aspersions on another's wasted intellectual capital. Frankly put, one thing that sincere Christians cannot do is allow the claim that we do not follow Christ to pass unchallenged. We may be terrible Christians. In fact, Christianity is predicated on the idea that we are all terrible at it, which is why we need Christ in the first place. But if someone denies we follow Christ as Lord, Savior, and God, well, we must resist that claim, however we can, with whatever poor tools we have, even if it annoys Petrie, even if it costs money, and even if we tire of repeating ourselves. If he does not understand this, he has understood nothing, whatever his pretensions. The author tells us what he would prefer. Quote, as a consequence, the saints took very seriously debates about faith and works, Christology, biblical authority, etc. These seemed a profound waste of time to me, who sought different and more challenging conversation partners to deal with more weighty philosophical questions. Close quote. Petrie is welcome to whatever questions please him with any conversation partners who will have him, but his statement drips with arrogance. How dare these devout Christians defend their views on matters that have interested Christians for the last 2 millennia? What a waste to spend time and money on questions of eternal significance, if the restored gospel means anything at all. He is annoyed that some with intellectual gifts spend time on questions that might have worried their less sophisticated brothers and sisters. It falls to the self-anointed wise and enlightened ones, those who are bored by the preoccupations of the masses, to deal with the challenging and weighty matters. Quote, such approaches as I sought, close quote, he tells us, quote, would be less worried about proving the myths and more invested in making the world better, close quote. Let us give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that the term myth is being used in the sense of a founding narrative or a story which gives metaphysical meaning, and not in the sense of fiction, though a similar supposedly revealing slip would be seized on by a queer theorist to launch the deconstruction. We can see plainly, though, the same sort of claims that Fanon highlighted with the colonizers' preoccupation with Algerian women. The way the natives are doing it doesn't help the world. If anything, it makes it worse. The intellectuals, as representatives of the superior culture, must save the day, as Petrie tells us. Quote, some of the LDS intellectual class have begun to take more seriously secularism, not as an enemy, but as a real conversation partner, and begun a post-secular Mormonism. Such a conversation must join in the examination of power. Perhaps such a venture is also a dead end, but at least it might have something to say to the anti-temple of secular religion other than violence. Otherwise, we are all lost. Close quote. This is really extraordinary. Post-secular Mormonism, whatever that might be, besides trendy buzzwords, is potentially the only possible response other than violence. Without it, we are all lost. This borders on the delusional. Queer theory is not going to save the world or the church, if that is what we means. I wager more good is done for the world in 1 month by an average ward, notwithstanding its members' sins and foibles, than queer theory has done in its entire existence. One assumes Petrie thinks queer theory is an important part of this undertaking. Otherwise, it would be criminal to waste time with it. But to expect us to believe that queer theory can be anything but a tool for secular colonialism and religious parasitism is blind faith at best. This is the same type of messianic conviction one sees with other intellectual salvational schemes, from the Jacobins to the colonial apologists to the Marxists. We're assured this is about, quote, the examination of power, close quote, but it is surely also about the exercise of power in its own right. Imagine reposing confidence or power in someone who in the same breath is so manifestly and so arrogantly devoid of empathy for those not in his clique. If we are truly otherwise all lost, in whatever sense, then doesn't it become very tempting to do whatever it takes to make sure the worst doesn't happen? In the various Marxist iterations, for example, the ostensible goal of a fair and better world justified the slaughter of millions. Even if this is seen only in academic or intellectual terms, why shouldn't I shade the data? Why shouldn't I misrepresent the facts? Why shouldn't I shout down those who disagree? Why shouldn't I exercise whatever power I accrue to assure my own ascension? The stakes are simply too high to tolerate, quote, the LDS intellectual class, close quote, losing. Such considerations could explain much of what so mars Petrie's work. What luck that the colonists will get wealth, land, and dominion, while also being the only ones to do the right thing and spread civilization. It is very convenient. If Petrie took his philosophical postmodernism sincerely and consistently, he could avoid such foolishness. Phase 4. Institutional capture and assimilation. By now, some may be thinking, quote, surely none of this can apply because Queering's author is a member of the church, close quote. Such a reaction is superficially appealing, but it ignores a great deal of what we know about colonialism and its fourth phase. Fanon sees it as the culmination of the first three, quote, the establishment of a society where the political, social, and economic institutions are designed to benefit and maintain the superiority of the colonizer while simultaneously subjugating the colonized, close quote. An important part of this is, quote, institutions that reward those who assimilate into the colonizer's ways while punishing those who do not, close quote. For example, studies of Asian Americans found that, quote, when they were not recognized as being American and were seen as foreigners, they were more likely to attempt to prove that they belonged to the dominant group by demonstrating culture knowledge and practices of that group. Close quote. Due to intense psychological and social pressure, the, quote, colonized might develop a desire to rid themselves of such identities and to emulate the colonizer because their ways are seen as superior. Further, the colonized may eventually feel a sense of gratitude and indebtedness toward the colonizer for civilizing and enlightening the colonized, close quote. There is, I think, something of a tragic sense of this in the sole selection of Queering that struck me as disarmingly, unexpectedly candid. Quote, I concede that I too am haunted by polygamy, not only because it was part of my own family lineage, but because my own hard-fought respectability has come at the expense of a disavowal of polygamy at an individual and a corporate level. Latter-day Saints were able to enter into the mainstream of American politics, education, business, and culture by embracing a respectability politics of conventional sexual and kinship practices. My subjectivity as an integrated, assimilated Mormon who has benefited from elite institutions has depended on my own normalization into conventional American sexualities. And I am just one example of the largely successful Mormon assimilation project that is hinged on a disavowal of patriarchal polygamy. Such a disavowal is the condition for contemporary Mormon assimilation, and the fear of its undoing remains palpable. Close quote. We see all the hallmarks to which Fanon points, the almost pathetic gratitude for acceptance, the sense that all of this is potentially tenuous, the need to personally disavow polygamy to keep his own hard-fought respectability, and the sincere conviction that he really is better off and more enlightened because of what the colonizer has offered. Irony remains abundant. Petrie recognizes the 19th century oppression, likely because he was at risk from its legacy. He is blind to the 21st century colonial oppression that he is part of, perhaps because he stands to benefit from it. Quote, one of the most destructive and insidious consequences of colonialism, close quote, writes one, quote, happens when the colonized begins to think, feel, and act like the colonizers, particularly as it relates to the stereotypes and prejudices of themselves and their own people, close quote. One can certainly see that spirit in Petrie's caricature of Latter-day Saint intellectual life before the glorious advent of post-secular Mormonism. Personally, I'm not nearly so convinced of the success of, quote, the largely successful Mormon assimilation project, close quote. I am grateful that I do not have the risks that my ancestor did, but I do not regard my family's continued economic or political safety and acceptance as a done deal, polygamy or no. As illustrated previously, the elite academic and media worlds largely continue in an implacable hostility and often outright bigotry, while our doctrine on sex and gender increasingly threatens any place we might have in the mainstream. Queer theory is the forefront of these efforts to marginalize us. The fact is, we are at risk for precisely the same reason as we were with plural marriage. We refuse to accede to the dominant society's stance on sex and marriage, even if the political meaning of that refusal has changed. I know professionals in the academy, social work, psychology, and medicine who keep their heads down in training, lest they run afoul of similar moral crusaders who could threaten their licensure or tenure. Medical trainees are blackballed and told so in writing because of their faith's social views. That's the sort of thing elites only do when they are implacably convinced of both their own rectitude and their own overwhelming power. Church members who dared to flout elite opinion on gay marriage in California often suffered substantial personal and economic harm. Their ongoing right to express their beliefs was explicitly challenged by a government official who made barely veiled threats. In short, if Petrie is convinced of the success of Latter-day Saint assimilation, that is likely only because he has assimilated, and no aspects of his personal beliefs are seriously at odds with the dominant culture in which he swims. He is, as he says, an, quote, integrated, assimilated Mormon, close quote, and evidently working to colonize the rest. His assurance is typical of the reactions of many to colonialism. Those who hope to assimilate typically feel pressure to actively deny the ongoing racism or prejudice that their group experiences. It is also typical for some of the colonized to turn on their fellows. Quote, oppressed group members may begin to discriminate against one another and choose to emulate and identify with oppressors. The oppressor becomes the model of acceptable humanity. To effectively emulate the oppressed must devalue his or her own group membership. Close quote. Native American authors believe that it matters a great deal, quote, whether or not our own people, our storytellers, content creators, professors, lawyers, doctors, scholars, engineers, scientists, teachers, and so on, maliciously laugh at, make fun of, criticize, speak ill of, or degrade even for the slightest moment in their own mental process, any spiritual practice or expressive natures of our own practices. Close quote. Those who opt for assimilation and denigration of their past identity are valuable to the colonizer. Quote, the oppressors would always hold up and point to the few natives who were supportive, close quote, of what the rest saw as racist imagery. Petrie provides a sterling example of the same phenomenon when Heretic, the Hugh Grant movie featuring the torment and murder of sister missionaries, came out. His reaction was striking. Quote, "As a scholar of religion and a Latter-day Saint, I consider that this is perhaps the greatest LDS story ever told, and a crucial commentary. I'll get straight to the point. Only an endowed Latter-day Saint can understand this film fully. It is written for them, and many missed it." Close quote. We first note the gushing over-the-top praise. Even if we grant that the film is a genuine work of art, which may be stretching even Latter-day Saint generosity too far, this seems a bit much. Quote, "the greatest LDS story ever told," close quote. Crucial? Please. At least Fanon's colonized intellectual could embrace Shakespeare. This isn't a considered measured judgment. This is a full-throated rendition of Rule of Britannia. We see, too, the frantic waving of credentials. Latter-day Saint scholar of religion, temple initiate. I should be taken seriously here. I am uniquely qualified to hold forth. Who would dare challenge such an intersectional flush of identities? Petrie goes on to explain that Heretic is a somewhat coded reenactment of the temple endowment. Quote, "The entire film is an inversion of the LDS endowment ceremony. The home is the anti-temple, the movement from room to room, specific words and phrases, the instructions at the doors, the visual aids, the altar, the location of the cuts the two sister missionaries receive. If you don't know the temple symbolism, you cannot fully understand the film's message. Yes, it is a secular critique of religion, sometimes quite powerful and sometimes quite silly, but it does so from a place of so deeply embedded in Mormonism that it is not just a superficial trotting out of embarrassing facts or logical problems, but one that turns its symbolic universe upside down, painfully so." Close quote. The film is, it would seem, yet another form of queering. It helps to invoke the temple, which he knows no believing member is going to debate in public. The non-member audience will be inclined to think this is great. How could his claims be unfair to Mormons? He does know about the temple, and no member will gainsay him. He is the ultimate outsider-insider, with neither group inclined or positioned to challenge him. As always in these cases, it is the dominant group who are the good guys. Petrie reproves church members for not appreciating what the gracious outsiders offer them. Quote, "It is written for them, and many missed it." Close quote. How ungrateful and short-sighted of us. The Hollywood horror film writers tried to reach across the aisle and enlighten us, and we were too ill-informed or blind to plunk down our money at the Odeon. Even if we grant the film enough sophistication to do what Petrie claims, it is telling that he thinks we should respond positively to the twisted recapitulation of our most sacred rites. Painfully so, in a horror movie that is at times a quite powerful secular critique of religion. In fact, repurposing sacred rites for a horror film would be an excellent, if overwrought, symbolic take on colonialism in general. A fiction that used it would probably be seen as inadequately subtle, but it is all real in this case. Note that my point is not the movie's merits or lack thereof. Instead, what's revealing is the stereotypical tactics and reaction. There remains a faint undercurrent of fear in Petrie's pro forma disavowals of polygamy, the over-the-top enthusiasm for a horror movie, and the calling out of racism and patriarchy, and the zealous queering of the tradition. That fear is, I warrant, fully justified. After all, how long would Petrie last in academic queer theory and gender studies if he was even mistakenly thought guilty of wrongthink? There might even be a tendency to overcompensate to avoid risking that, quote, hard-fought respectability, close quote. These departments and worldviews are not bastions of irenic tolerance, whatever they might claim. Furthermore, his employer, Kalamazoo College, receives a great deal of funding from the Arcus Foundation, $66 million as of 2018. The foundation's CEO and founder is a gay billionaire, John Stryker. Arcus has not hesitated to use funding to target attitudes in conservative religious groups. Quote, "The Arcus Foundation dispenses millions of dollars in grants every year to support LGBT activism. Its 2014 grants included $120,000 to the Religion News Foundation, the owner of the widely syndicated Religion News Service. The Arcus Foundation's grant listing said the 1 year of support was intended, quote, to recruit and equip LGBT supporting leaders and advocates to counter rejection and antagonism within traditionally conservative Christian churches, close quote. Massive amounts of money from ideological allies of queer theory are thus poured in. One need not receive any money directly to be affected. Are we to believe that this has no influence on university pressures and policies? No impact on chances for professional advancement? Do the risks of power that Petrie is so keen to highlight and interrogate in others somehow vanish when he is involved? Would not conservative billionaires leveraging their money for power attract his ire? Why hasn't he gone on the offensive to deconstruct a mega-rich donor's largely unaccountable concentration of power on his home turf? Admittedly, that would be dangerous to perceived power. Postmodernism is right when it reminds us that none of us are without biases and blind spots. And what could be more tyrannical than to be professionally at risk on these terms? I'm certainly not saying that Petrie is insincere or mercenary in what he says or does. But one would hope there would be more self-awareness of the power imbalance and risks. Fanon's colonized native intellectuals were also totally sincere and still useful tools of oppression. Queering seems like a textbook case of intra-ethnic othering, a process, quote, whereby an individual singles out and discriminates against other individuals of the same group who are less assimilated to American, i.e. academic, secular, left, queer culture, to create distance from the stigma created by Asian, or Mormon, stereotypes of inferiority, as well as a way to gain acceptance from white, or dominant, acquaintances. Close quote. In the postmodern colonialist view, problematic heteronormative Mormon theology can be transformed through the magic of deconstruction and some historical legitimacy into a social and professional asset instead of a grave liability. As a bonus, he who helps pay the bills will not be displeased. At this remove, the colonizing pattern fits remarkably well. Whether it matches reality, only the author could tell us, and the postmodernisms would caution that even he may not know. A safe sort of bravery. Queer theory flatters itself that it is edgy and daring, subverting oppressive structures and cutting the oppressor down to size. As Martha Nussbaum warned more than a quarter century ago, quote, you will quickly find that subversion takes many forms, not all of them congenial to critical theory. As a perceptive libertarian student said to me, why can't I use these ideas to resist the tax structure or the anti-discrimination laws or perhaps even to join the militias? Others, less fond of liberty, might engage in the subversive performances of making fun of feminist remarks in class or ripping down the posters of a lesbian and gay law students association. These things happen. They are parodic and subversive. Why then aren't they daring and good? Close quote. Would it be legitimate to queer the Talmud in support of National Socialism? Why not turn Bantu mythology into a call for imperialism? Couldn't we put Amish literature on its head to support jingoistic militarism? Couldn't we take Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from a Birmingham Jail and rework its cosmos in defense of Jim Crow, apartheid, and the Ku Klux Klan? Couldn't the writings of suffragettes help repeal the 19th Amendment? Any of these would be far more daring and transgressive than anything queering does, and certainly the voices of fascists, imperialists, white supremacists, or those who oppress women's voting are marginalized in the academy and society far more than homosexuals or the genderqueer. But how would that, quote, hard-fought respectability, close quote, fare? Doubtless all these could be done. But would we regard those who did so as admirable or insightful, or even possessed of a modicum of good taste or scholastic ability? It requires no particular gifts besides shamelessness and a sort of low cunning. We can imagine the result before they are done, and they will probably be more tedious than we imagine. Such an undertaking would be, at best, a vapid academic, I cannot bring myself to say intellectual, game played for a small, self-congratulatory coterie of one's peers. Is it risible to think any of this, or queering's parallel tactics, could somehow make the world a better place? Avoiding intellectual colonialism. How then can we disagree without historical misrepresentation and manipulative intellectual colonization? I think the foundation is honesty. I personally have no problem if the church's history, leaders, scriptures, or doctrines are critiqued or analyzed. It doesn't even particularly trouble me if someone's verdict is negative. I could not care less if someone is enamored of queer theory, astrology, geocentrism, or even phlogiston. What I have a problem with is the evident conviction that the author can distort the record and trust that either no one will check or no one who matters will care. I am weary of the severe misrepresentation, significant falsehoods, sloppy work, sophistry, banal logical lapses, special pleading, and double standards. More bluntly, don't lie to me or about me. As one author noted perceptibly in terms that resonate with Doctrine and Covenants 93:30-32, quote, Immanuel Kant gives us one quite stringent rule. It is always wrong to lie under any circumstances. Because when you lie to somebody, you are robbing them of all the information they need to make autonomous decisions. And if you rob somebody of their autonomy, you are not only doing them a disservice, but you're also reducing their humanity. Because for Kant, a human is defined by our ability to choose. We are defined by freedom. But when you lie to somebody, you are treating them as a puppet, dancing to your plans and not their own. For Kant, we should never infantilize people. We should never lie to them. We should treat them with the dignity that their human autonomy deserves. Close quote. Religious matters can reflect deep differences, worldviews that cannot be reconciled, where neither party is likely to convince the other. Philosopher David Hancock asked, quote, under what circumstances, if any, is it reasonable for someone engaged in an argumentative exchange to decide that the two of them have a deep disagreement and to abandon the use of argument and resort to non-argumentative means of persuasion, means that do not involve an appeal to reasons in an effort to get the other person to adopt their position on the issue? To put the question another way, is it legitimate, morally, epistemically, politically, in discussion with someone who approaches a question from within a different form of life, to abandon appeal to reason altogether and instead seek to persuade them exclusively by means that do not appeal to reason? Close quote. This is precisely the situation in which queer studies finds itself vis-à-vis the Church of Jesus Christ. Our views are incommensurable, the exertions of a few to pretend otherwise notwithstanding. Queering at its base is an attempt to alter how either members or non-members of the church see its scripture, leaders, and doctrine. Queering does not do this via a reasoned appeal to evidence, and it misrepresents such evidence as it uses to a degree that can only be called calculated and willful. It is an attempt at unreasoning manipulation. It is propaganda. Hancock answered his own question of whether such tactics are ever proper. Quote, my answer is no. No, this is intellectual colonialism, which should be condemned in the same way and for the same reasons as forcible colonial domination of indigenous populations. Persuasion, without the use of reasons, colonizes the interlocutor's mind, displacing strongly held commitments without the free, informed, and prior consent of the sort required for legislative and administrative measures that may affect indigenous peoples. Someone who approaches an issue from within a different form of life should be respected in interpersonal discussion by being given reasons rather than being manipulated and by being listened to when they give their reasons. Close quote. Clearly, Latter-day Saint thinkers are not listened to by Queering and Tabernacles. The views of those such as Blake Osler, Mallory Hudson Castler, Erastus Snow, and Spencer W. Kimball are instead warped by a parody of scholarly practice to further the manipulation. That effort ends either in these saints' further marginalization or the assimilation of their community's beliefs into the worldview of the postmodern secular academic left. Mormon studies. All of this points to a broader malaise at the heart of too much of Mormon studies. Most fields of study would at least have the moral courage to defend their subject from misrepresentation or patently unjust historical treatment. They might even see that as their mandate. If, for political reasons, an anthropologist misrepresented another culture's view of divine things by describing them in terms suggestive of homosexual parent-child incest, a violation of one of the most universal human taboos, he or she would likely never recover professionally. But when this procedure is applied to Mormons, you get tenure and book awards. Thus, for Mormon studies, the tactics employed in Petrie's books demonstrate that the community does not police itself well. Members of the Guild evidently have few fears that historic or philosophic malpractice will be called out, much less that they will suffer any adverse career consequences. It is hard to imagine what whoppers won't be tolerated in the proper ideological context if Tabernacles is getting awards for history. Accountability to non-complicit peer review, which used to be the definitive control on all scholarly activity and the best solution we've ever found for the biases that postmodernity highlights, is sorely lacking. At the same time, there seems to be a great deal of informal policing for proper opinions and social attitudes. These factors get you exactly what you'd expect and exactly what you don't want in genuine thought. Ideological conformity based on fear and a tolerance or encouragement of shoddy work, if it conforms ideologically. Petrie notes somewhat condescendingly, quote, "Here is a secret for outsiders. The humanist ex-Mormon versus fundamental apologist Mormon dynamic that attracts so much online attention and massive amounts of money is a sideshow in the actual practice of Mormon studies scholarship. Almost everyone is friendly to one another," close quote. Cordiality is a virtue, be sure. Differences about ideas should not become personality clashes. But in the spirit of a postmodern interrogation of this text, is it not just possible that everyone is friendly to each other, in part because no one dares or bothers to correct even the most egregious errors? Could it not be that the editor of Dialogue has some implied or explicit, if he has ever used it before, power over those who might otherwise differ with his nonsense? And why the note of resentment that creeps in over the alleged massive amounts of money that fundamentalist apologists somehow attract? More discourse, more power plays. The cluster of perverse incentives that thus infects the field has led to a proliferation of a certain unfortunate species of Mormon studies scholar, whose work is both predictable and pedestrian, despite the assurances of fellow scholars. These scholars settle for dull thrills when it is their turn to épater le bourgeois, procuring an ink-stained 15 minutes of fame when the Salt Lake Tribune anoints them as the expert du jour on anything remotely connected to the church. Such scholars enjoy self-satisfying bursts of moral grandstanding on social media, and if they are lucky, a sinecure at a third-rate college. Sycophantic, over-the-top reviews, which the scholars will be expected to reciprocate, round out the deal. Petrie provides specimens of exactly what is wanted. Quote, "So grateful for the first review by theologian Bay Orion Ward. Fundamentally transformative potential, had me awestruck and grinning. Patient and generous. What dream reviews are made of. Highlighted screenshots are available in case any should doubt the praise. Also, so grateful for this in-depth review with the great Caroline Klein. She says it will be one of the most important books in Mormon studies. Very honored by this thoughtful and sanguine review of my book by the amazing author John Turner. Worth reading the whole thing. There is no sign, incidentally, that these texts are to be deconstructed, so that what sounds like fulsome praise is really condemnation. As with Heretic, we see again the gushing superlatives at every opportunity. Very honored, amazing scholar, so grateful, the great Carol Klein, one of the most important books in Mormon studies. Fundamentally transformative potential, awestruck. Everyone is declared stellar, and everything they produce is greeted as the most brilliant or path-breaking work yet, even the book reviews. The field goes from strength to strength, apparently. Yet there's an insecure, forced, fixed grin quality to all this backslapping bonhomie and mutual admiration. It doesn't sound healthy or candid. Someone even has to chime in on Petrie's take on Heretic, quote, "This is a very smart take. Thanks, Taylor," close quote. If only it were sometimes said, quote, "This is a really bad take. Do better, Taylor," close quote. But perhaps it is too much to assume that one academic can see how another uses, or more properly, misuses sources. It is much easier to go along with the in crowd and give shallow kudos and cheap praise. Given what we have seen in the book, is it not possible that this praise is a tad excessive? And should such a deceptive and manipulative attempt at intellectual colonization be lauded? do the enthusiastic reviewers know the facts and do not care? Or are they too ignorant to know? Maybe the dog really can't play basketball after all. Conclusion. In the end, the surprise is not that some will give over honesty, rigor, and fairness for assimilation, self-preservation, or power. If queer theory is to be believed, that's all there is in the end. But it is astonishing what trivial gains are accounted worth that price, and how many play along via silence. At least Richard Rich got whales and a shiny chain of office. Petrie can, of course, continue to write and say and do whatever he likes, and doubtless will. Others can continue to gush and fawn at whatever they please, and doubtless will. I would not have it otherwise. I just hope the latter are doing so out of honesty and genuine conviction. Is it too much to ask that our history and text not be misrepresented, and that our leaders be quoted and characterized accurately? Queering and its predecessor volume failed this minimum standard in ways that are both indisputable and inexcusable. There are some in Mormon studies, safe from the legitimate fears that others have of speaking up, that could disincentivize such behavior had they the will. The American Historical Association even says it's their duty. In any case, we neither asked for nor want the strip mining of our theology for the queer industrial complex. You can put down your white man's burden. We've seen this movie before. We already have enough installments of Air Bud. Gregory L. Smith studied research, physiology, and English at the University of Alberta, but he escaped into medical school before earning his bachelor's degree. He was an associate editor for the Mormon Studies Review at BYU's Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship from 2011 to 2012. He works as a rural family doctor, providing cradle-to-grave care. This has been a recording of Intellectual Colonialism and Air Bud Theology, More on Queer Theory and the Church of Jesus Christ by Gregory L. Smith, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship, Volume 67, 2026, read by Victor Wirth. This audio recording is copyrighted under a Creative Commons license and may be freely distributed if it remains unchanged, the journal and its website are credited, and is for non-commercial use. A printed version of this and many other articles on Latter-day Saint Scripture can be found at journal.interpreterfoundation.org. More information about the Interpreter Foundation, along with a wide array of additional resources, can be found at interpreterfoundation.org.